From Pop Evil. That's the biggest song in rock. That does it for us this week. If you miss any part of our chart, you can get caught up at thesideshowcountdown.com.
And make sure you're back with us next week, because we're talking with Dean DeLeo from Stone Temple Pilots.
I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
We'll see ya.
The Side Show is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. We're laughing to keep from crying.
That's right.
Yeah, city's bankrupt.
The world's gone mad, Peter.
The Zimmerman case still hanging on. You know, there is only one good thing that's happened because of this George Zimmerman acquittal. Suddenly, there's lots of African Americans on television giving their opinions.
Oh, they're allowing them.
They're
on.
Allowing
oh,
them. On.
Hey, yeah. How about that?
Because fairness and accuracy in reporting, fair.org, actually a great site. Check it out, and you can see what is presented to us in terms of news. And it's not just beating up. By the way, it's not just beating up on Fox News, which deserves to be beat up on, but MSNBC
and the New York Times,
you know, all these NPR, all these liberal icons, you know, they dish their share of BS as well. But one of the things they do, one of the things that Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting does, is they do this analysis of who appears on these talk shows, Sunday morning talk shows like Beat the Press and
Beat what, the Press.
Yeah,
I kind of like that better.
Yeah, all those things. I have never watched one. I see little, you know, you see blips from them on the news. But anyway, they guess what? They're overwhelmingly white. They're overwhelmingly conservative. Yeah. They're overwhelmingly elected officials.
They try to balance it a little bit.
You know, they've gotten such criticism in the last few years that they've tried to do a little. But don't you think it would be pretty interesting, particularly if you didn't have just some stupid shout fest the way on some of these like Fox News things where they let a liberal, like a cat with a bell around its neck, in, you know, for a few seconds so they can beat up on him.
But it goes on just that happens on CNN. I mean, when we used to do MSNBC and CNN, we got into some pretty tough stuff.
Yeah. But, you know, on these, I mean, they have some decorum on those, and there's such room for all political opinions, and they're mostly and gender, too. It's overwhelmingly white, male, conservative elected officials.
And if it's a chick, she's usually just this Barbie doll babe pretending she has a brain.
And the other thing is that it would be a more interesting program. The reason that I don't listen to it is they're boring. Who wants to hear a presidential spokesman or the head of the Republicans in the Senate or something, or the head of the Democrats in the Senate? Yeah, because they're just going to be really putting forth this guarded statements.
Guarded and well crafted.
Yeah, exactly. All right, hey, this is a talk show. We'd invite your participation. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
You can always look at my website, which is Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. But a lot of what is on there, look at that one. But a lot of what's on there, I was going to say you don't really have to go there. You should. There's a lot on the website.
You should go there because there's a lot more on there than Facebook. But we want you to come to our Facebook page as well, which is
Facebook.com/nightcall.
Yeah.
And we also get a lot of emails. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
You got a few doozies this past week that you passed along to me.
Oh, the stories.
Emails and stories.
The emails.
Yeah. A couple of crazy people. Come on, Peter.
Oh. I'll have to remember. You know, I mean, this is not going to.
Well, it just happens.
Nothing that'll cost me my job or anything.
No,
I hope
it happens so much that they all blend together.
You know, these guys, they send these emails and suddenly,
yeah.
I mean, why don't they ever learn that you can't send out emails and nobody find out about them?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I mean, to the point where they're trusted people. I'm involved in some other projects that don't have to do with the radio station. And sometimes I'll say something critical about someone else and send it to somebody I trust.
Yeah.
And I go, you know what? I don't need to put that line in there.
Right. That's true.
And I would say there's next to no chance the other person will ever see it that I'm being critical of.
Yeah.
But I
You're not being mean.
No.
Sometimes
I'm being mean. But I don't send it. Well, one of the things, we're going to actually have some bright spots in the program. And Julian was talking before the program about people that are doing interesting and good things in this town, trying to improve the quality of life amidst the bankruptcy and all that. And we were also talking about my ability to pronounce names. And here I have to try this one here. There is an incredible coffee house, maybe, performance space called Trinosophies. Hey, yeah, that's it.
That was the other. You have another one that you're going to have trouble with.
I thought you'd say Gesundheit when I Trinosophies.
Okay.
And it is a coffee house and is a performance space. And a friend of mine and I on Friday night saw the Doomsday Philharmonic jazz group.
Yeah, how was that?
What a great name, huh? The Doomsday Philharmonic. Well, it's what they call improvised jazz or free jazz. So it's what my wife, who didn't go, calls chair throwing music.
Oh God, your wife!
But and so I asked.
And she's not a violent woman.
No.
Feisty.
But there's this great orchestra leader that did a lot of music during the 50s, 60s, 70s, Sun Ra. And Sun Ra and his Solar Orchestra.
Yeah.
And they would do a lot of music. They actually had charts, you know, music sheets that they would play off.
Like with the notes, you mean?
With the notes there, but then
sheet
they would
music.
Have a great amount of room for improvisation.
Right.
And in fact, there's a great group in Detroit called all these strange names, Planet D, Nanette. Uh-huh. Nanette is nine people, and they play Sun Ra music, which is absolutely, so it led by the absolutely fabulous R.J. Spangler, the drummer. Anyways, I'm so far.
You're going, you're floating. Yeah, you're just, come on back.
So, yeah. So I asked the people in the Doomsday Philharmonic that it was playing at the Trinosophies, which is, by the way, right across, it's on Gratiot Avenue, just a little east of downtown, right across from the Gratiot Central Market, the Eastern Market.
Love right. it.
Okay. Yeah. So I said, do you guys play from charts? And he said, yeah. And so he said, but not with musical notes. So I said, what's on there? Well, you're a musician, right?
Yeah, but how do
Can you
play?
Read music?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, a lot of singer-songwriters don't, you know.
Well,
okay,
well
you do.
I'm trained,
right.
you know.
So they said they do it with numbers. And they tried to explain to me.
Oh, I know that. The 4 and the 1 and the 5, yeah.
No, no, not the right? not the time signature
oh,
at
it's
all.
Not, that's not no, the time no. signature.
Oh, well, okay. But they had different numbers, and then they would have, and you can only see this, of course, they would have hand signals, like, you know, they cross their arms, their fists clenched, and then they would hold up numbers and all
really?
That.
Really?
Yeah, it was very strange, but it was incredible. And they do, it's what they used to call a long time ago. Far out music.
Groovy, man.
Yeah, yeah. So, Trinosophies, which is Trinosophes. Yeah.
You sure you said that right?
Trinosophies. Well, I was good with Trinosophies.
Well, and you said it's a coffee house, but I love earlier when we always have a little pre-show meeting at Sunday yeah. evenings, and you said, well, you know, they do serve beer sometimes, too.
Oh,
did
no,
you
no.
do that for my trying to get me there?
No, they wouldn't serve beer
okay.
there. It's illegal. Anyway, is there anything important happened?
No, week? Not a no. thing.
Oh, yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, City is bankrupt, right? We know it because the financial emergency manager
said
filed
it.
For it. The governor said it was. Now, how do these guys get into running a city that has elected officials, even if things aren't going well?
It's the whole emergency manager.
You know, one of the things that people often say is you can't compare like how a family functions to how a country or even like a company does. But, you know, the question I keep posing is that why in the wealthiest country in the world do we have the highest number of poor people? And if you go by any reasonable standard, not the government standard or just what you or I may think, but if you go by, well, I guess it is by what you or I think now that I think of it, what would constitute living in poverty or near poverty? So you're poor or near poor. Many people, many observers say that it's really close to 50% of the American
yeah.
population. And I don't mean
and
you
rising.
Know, poor doesn't mean you're in rags, you know, picking cigarette butts off the street, living in homeless shelters. That's enough of that. There's more folks like that than any other wealthy industrialized country
that's
in
right.
the world.
Shameful.
But we're talking about people that have trouble meeting their basics that wind up, as you always point out poignantly, that there's children, millions of children that go to bed that have
hungry every night
are at risk are hungry or at risk of hunger.
Yeah, it's like 2 to 3 out of 5,
yeah, yeah.
depending on the study.
And at risk of hunger, that doesn't mean they're necessarily hungry, but it means that the circumstances, financial circumstances, are such that the next day they might. I mean, most of us that aren't in that position, we're at risk of eating too much, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have a situation, wealthiest country in the world, and we have the most poor people in the world. So why is that? Well, maybe they don't try hard enough.
Oh, my God.
Why don't they just get a good job? No, it's structural.
If they weren't so damn lazy.
It's structural. It's
God.
Built into how the system is put together.
Yeah, as we always talk about, it's similar to the caste system in India, where not everyone is going to be wealthy or make it or even be middle class, which is ever shrinking.
No matter, even if people started off from a level playing field, which they don't,
that's right.
There would still be the 1%
and the
middle class
us.
Below us and then, you know, the near poor and then the poor. If it was, you know, if the people that are already there didn't have massive advantages, then you couldn't tell who would wind up to be there. But you know that the rich The rich man's son is going to be a rich man. You know that the poor man's son is going to be the poor. I mean, there are people that go up, and there are some people that go down.
Yeah.
But virtually, they are statistical anomalies. I mean, it doesn't happen. Jalene's right. It's a caste system.
It's a caste system. And meanwhile, there's the headline that you sent me the other day. Says the richest 300 persons on earth have more money than the poorest 3 billion. The richest 300 persons.
Yeah, that's not 300 million or 300,000. 300
persons and 3 billion.
So extend that now into what has happened in Detroit. Bankruptcy has been declared. Rushed to bankruptcy, by the way, without a single negotiation with unions or workers or retirees. And the fear was, in fact, that happened, was that because that the Michigan State Constitution says that you can't deny pension people's pensions to them in the Michigan Constitution.
Yeah.
So they just tried to ram that through. I mean, in fact, an Ingham County Circuit judge on Friday afternoon said that Detroit's bankruptcy filing is unconstitutional and must be withdrawn.
So, and how much legs does that have?
Well, we'll
I
see.
Wonder.
Tomorrow, Monday.
Right. There's a court hearing, right?
There'll be a court hearing, yeah. And the unions are saying that Kevin Orr, the financial emergency manager, and, of course, the Republican governor, rushed into bankruptcy to subvert the democratic process and avoid the Michigan constitutional mandate requiring municipal governments to keep their word on pension contracts with retirees. Now, the deal is, with this whole financial manager crap, that contracts that are supposed to be the basis, written contracts, mm-hmm. legally binding contracts, suddenly become null and void when a governor announces that a city is in financial emergency, appoints somebody who becomes the dictator. I mean, the reason that they're written financial contracts is that capitalism is such a vile system and here's why I say vile, is that human trust evaporates. I mean, you don't have a contract with your, well, I guess some people do. With your wife or your husband when you get married. You know, they do have some prenuptials and agreements and all that. That's for wealthy people. But when you love people, when you're in community with them, when you're in family with them, you don't have written contracts.
Yeah.
But we know that even with the law enforcing contracts that, these banksters and these capitalists and all that, they do everything they can to cheat people. It's a system just based on looting and based on, I mean, hey, a lot of us,
we're getting played.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In the world, you know, some of us are okay. You know, I mean, if you can kind of deal with the ethical end of it, that because, you know, you're rich, and I'm in the 1%, and so are you internationally.
Not the 1% in the United States.
Yeah, but 1%.
By any means.
Yeah. We're not the 300 in the 300 that have more money than the 3 billion or the more wealth.
No.
So this is the state takeover of city government. You have to remember. And it's part of this corporate agenda of privatization, and it's going to wind up, I think, worse for Detroiters. But
they're going to privatize everything.
The people in Michigan did not want this. Remember, last November, Michigan voters, because they feared the possibility that Governor Snyder was going to force bankruptcy on Detroit, voted in a referendum to repeal the law that gave him the power to appoint an emergency manager such as the one that exists now. So what did Snyder do, this great believer in democracy?
Oh, sure.
He called the Republicans into lame duck session, and the Republicans forced through this new law that gave him this virtually the same power of the law that the voters had just struck down. So this is just a total scam.
Power to the people, huh?
Yeah, power to the corporation. The unelected manager, which is the dictator of Detroit, Kevin Orr, is a former corporate bankruptcy lawyer with a firm called Jones Day, the largest corporate law firm in the world.
How many attorneys?
Thousands.
From,
so, but emergency manager Orr resigned. But then he hired Jones Day to manage the debt restructuring.
Of course he did.
I mean, and they're even talking about selling off art artifacts from the Detroit Institute of Arts.
Oh, God, that makes me so sick.
So the point being, just as we wonder, well, I mean, I don't wonder. I know why. But I ask, why in the wealthiest country in the world do we have the highest amount of poverty? And why in the wealthiest country in the world do we have any number of cities throughout the United States going bankrupt? Well, the really stupid and with a subtext of racism narrative is, well, because of Coleman and Kwame.
Oh, yeah, I know. In fact, I had a conversation with someone the other day who said something about why this is all happening. And he said, tagged, I'm at the Coleman A. Young Municipal Center. So yeah. He was alluding to that. And I said, I'd love to hear you and Peter Werby sit down and have a conversation. You know this guy. And he goes, he would agree with me. I said, oh, hell no. He would not agree with you.
Well, yeah, if you want to join us, 313-298-WRIF. And by the way, I was surprised, is that Governor Snyder actually said something that made sense. He said, this is a process that's been going on for 60 years. And it didn't start with the administration of Coleman Young. And Coleman Young was an African American who was elected in 1972 and took over a failing city. And Kwame is Kwame Kilpatrick, who turned out to be this, total crook. Just kind of cut the heart out of Detroit more than anything. It wasn't so much a financial thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, it's a process of deindustrialization. So the people that are responsible for the fact that there's almost half the population are either near poor or poor, the people that are responsible for the cities being bankrupt and other cities not having enough money are, guess who?
White men, right?
White men in $2,000 suits, wearing $10,000 watches, and having so much money they don't even literally know what to do with it, so they just park it. They don't invest it, and they just sit on it.
And they don't give one
hoot about it. Yeah, we can say that. Here it is. Governor Rick Snyder says this is a difficult step, but the only viable option to address a problem that has been six decades in the making, because it goes back to the 1950s and the deindustrialization of Detroit. Because, I say this a lot, rather than pay working class people a decent wage, a middle class wage,
a fair and living wage,
they decided it would be cheaper first to go to the American South, and then they thought it would even be really sharp to go to other countries where they could get everything done everything done in a manner that echoed the 1880s or something like that. And that's where we're headed back for. So it is all a scam of the first magnitude, to be sure. Now, if I could find one of, let me see where I want to look up on my board here. Here. We haven't played this in a long time. That's Crocus, Eat the Rich, and hey, they're eating us.
Also was done by Aerosmith, but we like that old one.
I can't find my all of my...
what do you need?
Here it is.
There you
my
go.
Eat the Rich thing. So, okay, some of you say, well, that's just so totally rad, Eat the Rich. I actually,
because they're eating you.
Yeah. I think I played this interview last week. I replayed it. It was from the Occupy movement, and a friend of mine and I, he was going to film all this. He asked me if I would just act. He was doing a documentary on the Occupy movement back in late 2011, and he said, "Would you go down there? Campus? Where was it?
Grand Circus Park.
Yeah, and interview people, and I'll film it." And I said, "Sure." So there was this very young woman, booked 17 or 18.
Was this when we were there together and you went around interviewing
people?
Yeah,
you were
there.
But were you there? And I asked her, I said, she had a sign that said, Eat the Rich.
Yep.
And I said, what does that mean? And she said, what word don't you understand?
I do remember that.
Okay.
Oh, that
okay.
was great.
All right. So that's too rad. Oh, no. Come on. We can't advocate eating the rich either metaphorically, which would mean a wealth tax, which would strip most of these people of this impacted wealth that they don't use and is responsible for what we're seeing in Detroit. Any number of other cities around the country and in Michigan, and the poverty that we experience. So if it's not eat the rich, how about begging? How about begging them?
That doesn't work.
How about we could just get like, they have
down and kiss their feet?
Marching on Washington, but we could march like on the Koch brothers, who together are worth, they split it up evenly. They're both worth $31 billion.
Wow.
So they got $62 billion. So the $18 billion that is the long-term debt that Detroit has.
Yeah,
it's long-term. It's not like anybody's saying, give me the $18 billion. Or we're taking you out. It's extended, so it's not as quite as bad as it sounds. But $18 billion in a way is just sort of a rounding figure to them. I mean, they could just pull it out of their pockets.
Oh, to the Koch brothers.
So maybe we could have like a general begging movement, and people could crawl to the ultra wealthy. What do you think about
that?
Disgusting. Yeah, I crawl, please, sir, please help us.
Give me a dime.
Help the poor. Make it set it up for Halloween and go to their Park Avenue, big mansions in their apartments. They're $91 million apartments and all that. Remember that was the one? $91 million for the penthouse, and the help lived in one that was $4 million. And they wouldn't sell that to anybody, but the help didn't have to buy it. I mean, the other people had to buy it.
How generous.
There are some
them.
Other things that could be. I mean, I think given the quiescence, the passivity and what have you, the American people, I think the begging movement probably is the only thing that's possible. In other countries, Greece and Britain, France, Brazil, where's this happen? A lot of other places like that, they have mass movements. They have general strikes where people say, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. I mean, for one thing, it is, it's.
People are afraid to do that in this country.
Well, because right now, who's ever listening to this and trying to make sense of what are they serious what they're talking about? yeah, we are.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely. Eat the rich. Which word don't you understand? People say, well, if they had the rich, if you got rid of all the rich, you wouldn't have.
And you wouldn't have worked for,
I know. But we'd have all their money.
So we'd have the jobs.
We'd have all their money.
Even
they earned it. Well, you know what? The Koch brothers didn't earn it. They got it from their daddies. You know what?
They were handed it, and they are greedy, awful men.
Yeah, the Waltons, $125 billion between the five of them they're worth.
Aw, poor bees.
But what's her name? Alice. She's opened a really nice art gallery.
It's full of beautiful art.
Things. Yeah.
Yes.
So, general strikes and what's going on in most of these countries are led by labor unions. So, they've been gutted. But let's see. Here, big banks flooded in profits, fear, flurry of new safeguards. So the nation's six largest banks reported $23 billion in profits in the second quarter. Hey, here's another thing we could do. How about this? We could get the Catholic Church on them and some of these other churches that believe in tithing.
Yeah?
Tithing. Right? You give 10% of your income
to the church.
Well, to the church. But here, and what's this new guy's name? Pope Francis?
I think so.
Yeah. Pope Francis, he's like a friend of the poor. Hold on here.
He is what?
There we go.
He is what?
He's a friend of the poor. I mean, he's always advocated for the poor. Also for the Argentine dictatorship, but that's another.
That's a whole other.
We don't want to go there.
Yeah.
But anyway, he could say, and these other religious leaders, hey, Richie Rich.
Because
kids.
They give, Peter. They do a lot. But we hear from people all the time, get mad at us because we're atheists. And they say, well, my church does this. My church does that. Well, why doesn't the biggest one who has so much money?
Oh, you're talking about the church itself ought to tithe. No, I mean, they ought to go to the wealthy.
The Catholic Church.
The Catholic Church or all these religious leaders.
They are the wealthy.
They are. But the richest American's net worth is now $1.7 trillion.
Oh,
so I would be challenged to figure out what 10% of that is.
No math
but
on
it's
the
a
air.
Lot. It's a lot. It would take care of Detroit's problems and Hamtramck's problems. And, if you left these poor SOBs with, let's not be real commie. Like, I feel generous tonight.
What?
50 million.
Who are you? What have you done with
million.
My Peter?
Leave them all with 50 million, all right? But here's what I always call capitalist blackmail. So the Treasury Department and senior regulators, also congressmen, they want to make banks safer. They want them to have more cash on hand. So if anything like the last time they sank the economy, they'd be able to cover it, right? They wouldn't have all this money out in these insane investments, and they always call them exotic instruments, right? Whatever that is.
That's a doozy.
Yeah.
Please. When I think of exotic instruments, it's not that.
Let's not go there. Yeah, all right. But so here's what the banks say. They've warned that more regulation, what regulation is it, could undermine their ability to compete and could curtail the amount of money they have to lend. They're not lending anything.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe a little
it's
more
kind of
now.
Come to a bit of a standstill.
Let's see. The banks did not demonstrate any difficulty in meeting the proposed rules, and the banks now appear to have fewer allies in Washington. What they want is they want more money to gamble with and to distribute to their stockholders. That's what it's all about. Because the more they gamble on this great crap game, the stock market, the more they can receive. And how about this? Where was this thing here? Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and J.P. Morgan Investment Bank paid compensation to their people of $41 billion. Three people paid out 40, or three companies poured, paid out $41 billion.
Yeah. You know?
So what do you say, folks? Eat the rich or no? But one of the reasons they can gamble like this is, I mean, what happens, you know, whenever you hear these ads, like on WRIF or any of the other stations about the casinos, they always put in there, if you have a problem with gambling,
call 1-800.
Call 1-800.
Gamble off or whatever it is.
Yeah. but these folks don't have to worry because
hell no.
They gamble and they lose, but they don't lose everything.
Because they'll gamble again and they'll win a
lot. Because they get bailed out.
Well, that's true.
And, gee, I wonder who else could be bailed out. How about the city of Detroit?
How about
it?
Oh,
no.
Yeah, let them figure it out.
Yeah.
Right?
So,
let the people suffer.
See, anything more in here? Largest banks now dominate the industry. Their second quarter profits were up 40% compared with those in the period a year earlier. And over the last 12 months, their combined profits were more than $70 billion. So, this could kind of handle Detroit's problems, right? And a lot of other cities as well. So why should people be faced with this is what I want to know. Tim from Bellevue writes in, don't eat the rich, they're spoiled.
Like rotten, ew.
You know, I got a lot more things to say and a lot more reason to eat the rich. But one of the things Jalene and I were talking about is getting some people on the air that are doing good things in Detroit. They're not going to overcome the banksters and the scamsters that are running our lives at the top of it all. But they can boost the spirit. Right?
Yeah.
For sure. And we're going to talk to, is it fair to call him a graffiti artist?
He prefers to be described as an illustrator and artist, but he does some damn fine graffiti art, and we can get into that. And how he doesn't like to be pigeonholed. You know how we don't like to
be
pigeonholed?
I know. And you know what? You've probably seen his public art.
I guarantee you.
All right. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this. 101 WRIF.
Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
Get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 8/31/13.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit GEICO.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
John, are you sure we chose the right color to paint the living room?
Oh, for chameleon's sake, Val, you look beautiful when you turn blue.
I like it. I'm just not so sure I love it. You know how fickle I am.
Well, you did turn about 30 colors yesterday.
Did I?
Yeah. It's a good thing there's the Valspar Love Your Color Guarantee. If you don't love the color we chose, we get another free.
Really? Well, I guess the only thing to discuss now is dinner tonight. Cricket stir fry or grasshopper curry?
I was thinking mosquito parmesan.
Offer ends 10-7-13. See loveyourcolor.com for offer terms.
101 WRIF.
Welcome to
Everything That Rocks.
Yeah!
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Thank you. This is our second segment, and we've been talking about the bad news, Detroit having filed for bankruptcy. Actually, it's kind of a misnomer to say Detroit has filed for bankruptcy. The dictator of Detroit, the emergency financial manager, acting at the behest of the governor of the state, has done that. And the question I was asking, you know, why in the wealthiest country in the world do we have anybody going bankrupt, any person suffering this kind of poverty in our cities? But we're also talking about what's good around here. Detroit has become a real center for the arts. The people moving
culture
from
and arts, yeah,
literally around the world. And joining us right now is Kobe Solomon. He's a local illustrator and artist, and you've probably seen some of his stuff around. Kobe, welcome.
Wait, you have to hit the button, Peter.
Oh, okay, good.
Come on.
Good. Thank you. There he is.
Hey,
Kobe. Hi, Kobe. You're on the air. Welcome to the broadcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Hey. Yeah, tell us where we may have seen some of your public art.
Well, let me set it up because for a lot of people, and then we'll let the poor guy talk. If you've driven anywhere between downtown Metro Detroit and you look over at the Russell Industrial Center, you see that giant mural of the tiger with the big red wings and so many other things, covers the entire side of the building of the Russell Industrial Center. And Kobe is responsible for that piece.
Well, I asked him. Where have we seen your art? Well, she has answered it. Okay, Kobe. And I was told you painted that entire thing single-handedly?
Yes, sir. Yes, I did.
How in the world did you? That it scared me. I looked at it. I've seen it any number of times. And I looked at it after Jalene told me that, and I thought, whoa. Were you just scaffolding down it?
No. We didn't use scaffolding. We used an alternating boom, a JLG lift.
Like a lift, yeah.
85-footers to get up to the top of that.
Well, you know, the reason, and I took that back, the reason I called you a graffiti artist, I was looking at a website and a news item on there. It said, graffiti artist transforms local shop into work of art. But tell us, what's the difference between graffiti and public art? I mean, people think of graffiti as being often or usually unwanted and unsightly.
Well, yeah, they do. It's kind of a double-edged sword nowadays, because there's a lot of, guys that when they grew up, were, quote-unquote troublemakers and, managed to turn, the adversity of, the fact that they're a graffiti artist into professional employment, as artists. If I had to throw out the easiest description of the difference between the two, traditional street graffiti is done for free. It's only done for the artists, a lot of times there are younger guys that don't have the technical skill with the medium putting stuff up on the streets, and that's especially in Detroit because we're a little behind the rest of the world in terms of really realizing our individual abilities in street art and public art. So that's usually the proliferation of the mess that people are used to in this region. And, the public art are usually things that are funded and commissioned, and, we don't have to worry about looking over our shoulders the whole time.
And that's mainly what you do at this point, right?
Yeah, pretty much, officially, sure.
Well, it's interesting. I was thinking over 100 years ago when the modern art movement first hit, the Picassos and the rest, and they were so reviled by the traditional art movement. And same with graffiti, yet I see some of these articles, like from the Detroit News, that, Pierce Street in Birmingham getting a graffiti art, so it's moved.
Which you did, yeah.
It's moved up. It's moved up the Woodward corridor. So is what has been called graffiti mainstreaming?
Yeah. It really is. Street art and, what we know as graffiti right here in the Midwest is really, really dominating the world of contemporary art globally. An extremely high percentage of a lot of really successful gallery artists are either rooted in street art or overtly doing street art. treat art as their work. And, you know, for example, a primary flight, which takes place every year, akin to Art Basel, that has brought international artists here to Miami every year, and it completely transformed the Wynwood District of Miami from, you know, it used to be the pits, and now it's actually a really, really nice walk through marketing area and revenue stream.
And you've done your share of that. For example, up and down Woodward Avenue, you have done a lot. Tell us about that.
On Woodward, I don't have too many pieces. I have a couple that are off of Woodward. I have one that's on Hastings Street that was done for a private client, and I have one that's behind the Fox Theater on the side of Centaur Bar right next to Fire Engine 1.
Really? Well, that's
there
great.
Were some other ones, Peter, when we were looking at yeah. this art that you,
you know,
recognize.
There's one that is, I don't know if this, well, it's certainly public mural art, on the side of these buildings in that park in front of Detroit, what's the, you know, the big rail station. All of a sudden it's out of my mind. You know, right near Slow's
Bar. Roosevelt Park.
That what?
Roosevelt Park.
Roosevelt Park, yeah. And why can't I think of the name of this the train station?
Are we talking about the old train station or the one that's actually functioning?
No, the old one.
I think, what is it, Grand Michigan Central Depot?
Michigan Central, thank you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there's some great stuff there. All right, well, I think we got to get back to talking about the bad stuff of Detroit. I mean, do you have, a mission, a vision that this is...
Well, he told me he has a lot of exciting things planned for the summer, so carry on with that.
Yeah.
Question, Peter.
Well, I was going to say, do you have a sense of mission? I want to make the city look better.
Oh, definitely.
And what are the plans for the summer?
Plans for the summer, I'm working on a project with a building owner downtown. We're kind of keeping it under wraps until we're sure that we can get the necessary investors, but there's a potential for a public art installation that's twice the size of the Chimera being done in downtown in the next 6 or 7 months.
Oh, that's incredible. And you have a website, right?
My personal website, we're redoing it, but there is a website for the book that I published, and there's also a website where some of my images are about to be available on, for public purchase. The Chimera, for one, is a prime example.
And what is it? What's the website?
Oh, it's a sumo... Surface.com, but it's sumo spelled with two U's, so S-U-U-M-O.
Surface.com.
All right. You know what we'll do, Kobe? We'll put a link to that up on our Facebook page as well.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. Thanks.
Now, before you go, aren't you doing something on the is it the fire department by Kobo, that one?
No. It's over by, it's behind the Fox and across the street from Centaur.
Oh, that's the one you're talking about, yeah. Because you did that years ago, right?
Yep. I did it about... 2013? I did it about 10 or 11 years ago. And this coincidentally, the same fireman that hired me to do it, at the same time I was thinking about redoing it, you know, stopping me. You know, there's some really serious serendipity going on. So I got to redo the piece, and the fire station got a facelift on the mural.
That's amazing. And you went to the College for Creative Studies, right?
Yeah, I did.
So you're hometown all the way. Kobe Solomon, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast and being one of the elements that is making Detroit feel good.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. I'm trying.
All right. Well, keep up the great
keep it
work.
Up, Kobe.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. That's the good news.
That's the good news.
We get back to the bad news. Here's Mike. Mike's in Birmingham. Hey, Mike. Hi. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the bankruptcy in Detroit as of Thursday.
Sure.
Yeah. You want to know who's to blame for all of this? I'll tell you exactly who's to blame. This is all the fault of those stupid black people.
Oh, man. You know, this was a person. Yeah. We blocked that out. You know, actually, you know what? I don't know whether I should or I shouldn't have.
Hey, producers, remember 11:43. Yeah. We're going to cut that on out for the podcast. Yeah. That is so disgusting. Well, you are a disgusting human being. And how dare you?
He's when you say that, he's laughing.
Well, I don't care.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's laughing because he's evil, Peter.
Yeah.
How in the hell could someone actually get on the airwaves and say it? I can see being a racist hiding, you know, and you know, because most racists don't want people to know they're racist. But this guy is sick.
Well, he's sick. He's also stupid.
Yeah.
And it's part of a pathology that mires us in our inability to solve the problems that we face. And I don't know, you know, sure, people are,
I'm literally shaking right now. And we just had an African-American gentleman on as our guest. I'm embarrassed.
Did that go through the airwaves?
The mics are on, aren't they,
No,
Peter?
I mean, I hit the dump button.
Okay, well.
So you might not have heard it. You might not have heard it.
Well, it was vile.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he didn't say the N-word.
Well, so, I mean, that's a shocker.
Yeah, isn't that nice? Wasn't that white of him?
That was mighty white of him.
Yeah, yeah. But it is.
Hey, don't ever call here again. Thank you. I ban people once in a while, and you're out, buddy.
Yeah, well, you know.
Good thing we have caller ID.
Yeah, yeah. So we know his number. Yeah. Maybe, why don't we give it to the guy? Let's give it. I think we, Mike, if that's your name, we're going to give your number out.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll give it to you.
We've got some people who'd like to talk to you.
Yeah, all right. No, that's not true. We won't. but here. And I don't mean to diminish that individual prejudices don't congeal into support, essentially, of what we face. Why Detroit's bankrupt? Why there's so many poor people? And most of those poor people are white, as a matter of fact, or, you know, the poor and near poor.
Not in Detroit, in general, you mean?
In general, yeah, in this country. And so you start seeing the world through racial lenses, and then that does not allow you to understand the political and economic dynamics of capitalism and how it's functioned since its inception.
I say take another phone call, Peter. Let's lighten this thing up, hopefully.
All right. Well, I had kind of more to say about that.
Let's not make that the first example of the first phone call we had on the show tonight.
Here's Drew from New Haven who could have asked a good question of Kobe Solomon. But, Drew, go ahead. You're on the air. Maybe we could do it. Go ahead. All right. Ask your question.
First, I have a couple things I'd like to say. First, when you were talking about graffiti earlier, I think it should either be considered public art or graffiti, because the way that I see graffiti is I just think of big, ugly bubble letters on the side of a building.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when you say graffiti, I don't think...
But that's a very... I mean, I understand. I'm not dissing you or anything, dude, but that's a very narrow view of what it is, you know? And that,
well,
fortunately,
I mean,
interviews like that are opening that up.
But, you know, one of the things that happened in New York City was this huge anti-graffiti campaign, because, you know, these folks had just put it everywhere on everything. It's like I said, if I'm waiting for a train to go by and it's tagged, cool. I can look at that.
Dig it.
But, you know, usually most people don't want like graffiti in their neighborhood, though.
I mean, it's on my street once in a while. It doesn't really bother me.
Some of it is gang related.
Yeah, and clearly I don't know what some of it means, but I look at it and just go, all right. You know.
So.
And that's what I was talking about, was I was saying it should either be considered graffiti or public art, because public art is more appealing to the eye.
Well,
what do you want it to be?
As they say, Drew, you know, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And what I said as well, although it didn't take the same form, of course, was the modern art. You know, we think modern art. Well, modern art began in the first years of the 20th century, and there were almost riots where they had what was called the Armory Show here in the United States. And people were aghast that these people that did not show scenes of discernible human beings and landscapes and all that, that's not art. Anybody, and then when they had abstractions, you know, Jackson Pollock and stuff like that was just splattered, they'd say, anybody can do that.
Yeah, heard that one.
And I don't know, well, if they can, cool. And then if rich people want to pay millions for them, great for the artists.
I couldn't even do the splatter thing. That's how bad I am.
Go ahead, Drew.
All right. And the other thing I wanted to say was I would like to hear some Midnight Metal.
Hey, dude. Hey, I have really good news for you. Are you ready?
Yeah, he's ready.
Oh, he's gone.
He's ready.
Okay, but I'm sure he's listening. I have really good news for you. Tomorrow night at midnight, you're going to get yourself some midnight metal. All right? All right.
And who demands it's doing it?
Al Beck will be there. Slayer.
Slayer himself. Here's Adam in Livonia. Adam, thanks for calling. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, Sheila. How's it going there?
What did he say?
He's Sheila.
I'm not okay. Sheila.
I talked to a Sheila on the phone to be connected.
Yeah. Oh, no, that was me. That's Jalene. Sheila's been gone for about 25 years.
Really?
And I've been here for 15.
That's odd. I guess I'm a long-time caller, and I don't even know it.
Hey, man. All right. Whatever.
I wanted to talk to you guys, though, about you guys are pretty pessimistic about your view of Detroit right now. What's going on with that, guys?
Well,
are you for sure? Are you for real?
I mean, put it this way. Are you optimistic?
No, but I'm thinking that there's only one way to go. Do you guys agree with me?
Which way?
Well, yeah, explain first before we agree or disagree.
Okay. Let's go over the emergency manager. What did you guys say his original job was or his job was before this?
He was a bankruptcy specialist with this huge
attorney, right?
With this corporate law firm called Jones Day, yeah.
So he probably knows a thing or two about tearing down a corporation or building it up or selling assets, buying things.
Yeah,
he
definitely does.
But what about tearing down a city and picking it apart and privatizing everything?
And selling it off? I mean, we have a bunch of, buildings with graffiti all over it right now. Like, that's just wasted space.
Well, there's a lot of abandoned
buildings. Let's go with that.
He can't sell those. Those are privately held buildings. We're talking about the assets of Detroit. Look, the people of Detroit and the city workers, they didn't do anything wrong. They worked at their jobs diligently. Some people work very diligently, and people say, "Man, they just love it." But
most of them,
and they were expecting pensions. They didn't do anything wrong. They got the rug pulled out from under them because of these, particularly because of the deindustrialization, and they shouldn't have to pay the penalty at all. In fact, the U.S. government, as it saved some of these other corporations from going out of business, ought to do the same for Detroit and take a few billion out of the war budget.
The defense department.
Or just grab it from some of these. You could secretly take it from the Koch brothers or the Waltons. They never know it, It's not like, what happened to my $18 billion?
Well, it's like when I left it
on the dresser.
I used to take a 20 out of my mom's purse when I was young.
Yeah, they'd never know. They would never know. So, that's why we're saying eat the rich, because they got them, people need money. The cities need money. These people got money. They're not doing anything with it except destructive things. And let's have a wealth tax that will sort of even everything out. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Now, how do these companies and these firms make so much money? Now, remember what banks used to be. They used to be places where you would bring your 15 cents and put it in your little deposit.
And you'd wear your suit.
Yeah, or dad would put his would go there with his paycheck, and then when he needed money, he would go there and take some out, then got really modern, they'd write a check. But now banks don't do this. Here's, hey, Taylor, hang on, because I see you want to talk about graffiti, and so do we, so we'll get you in just a second. But here, this was in the New York Times today. Yeah, it's still Sunday. Hundreds of millions of times a day, thirsty Americans open a can of soda, beer, or juice. I don't think I sent this to you. Did you?
No.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
This is going to amaze you. It amazed me. And every time they do it, they pay a fraction of a penny more because of a shrewd maneuver by Goldman Sachs and other financial players that ultimately cost consumers billions of dollars. Wait a minute, Goldman Sachs, isn't that an investment bank?
Wait, wasn't there a bailout of some sort?
Yeah, how did they wind up doing aluminum? The story of how this works begins in 27 industrial warehouses in the Detroit area. Okay, it's not totally deindustrialized, but there's nothing being made there. Where a Goldman subsidiary stores customers' aluminum. Each day, a fleet of trucks shuffles 1,500-pound bars of the metal among the warehouses. Two or three times a day, sometimes more, the drivers make the same circuits. They're taking the same aluminum and driving
What's up with that?
Okay. They load in one warehouse, they unload in another, and then they do it again. The industrial dance has been choreographed by Goldman to exploit pricing regulations set up by an overseas commodity exchange, an investigation by the New York Times has found. The back and forth lengthens the storage time, and that adds many millions a year to the coffers of Goldman, which owns the warehouses and charges rent to store the metal. It also increases the price paid by manufacturers and consumers across the country. In other words, it artificially raises prices. And so
this is mind-boggling.
This is a scam.
Yeah.
No goods or services are provided. Well, here's a sentence. Where was this? The maneuvering in markets for oil, wheat, cotton, coffee, and more have brought billions in profits to investment banks like, here we go again, Goldman, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Morgan Stanley, while forcing consumers to pay more every time they fill up a gas tank, Click on a light switch, open a beer, or buy a cell phone.
God, they have their dirty little hands and everything.
But there's no goods or services provided, and the key word here is maneuvering.
Yeah.
So
literally.
So these are banksters, scamsters that are playing with the financial system, and we are at the bottom grubbing for this and that amount of money and saying things like this moron that called, you know, it's their fault, or it's,
this, my God.
Can we get another million here? I mean, these people are dealing in billions, and they must. I would say that they would laugh at us, except I don't even think they pay the slightest bit of attention. They couldn't care less. Yeah.
Correct.
And that's why we say, eat the rich.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. The WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Detroit's new home for Dave and Chuck the Freak is 101 The Riff.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. And we're talking about graffiti. We just spoke with a man who's doing some wonderful art in Detroit. And on the walls of the city, all, by the way, commissioned.
Yes.
They want him to do it. Everywhere from downtown Detroit to the Russell Industrial Center, and you can see from I-75 this enormous
mural,
and out to Dearborn. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, and there was an article up there, which Jolene mentioned earlier, the richest 300 people on Earth have more money than the poorest 3 billion. And Lewis writes in, but they've earned it.
There we go again. Yeah, we've heard that one, Lewis.
I'm not even 100% sure what that means. I would probably find out that great numbers of them inherited it. But even if they so-called earned it, why should people be able
to... Why shouldn't they pay their fair share?
Yeah, why shouldn't, since, they're... All of this has to do, and in fact, our guest at 1 a.m., who is Carolyn Raffensperger. I knew I wasn't going to be able to say it. Raffensperger. There you go. Raffensperger.
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 Ahmadinejad.
Ahmadinejad. Yeah, he's gone. He's director of the Science Environmental Health Network, talks about that sense, about the commons and how everyone is immersed in it. And the fact that some of us wind up, a very, 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 very tiny minority wind up extremely wealthy, and a huge, enormous number, particularly internationally, wind up so poor, they're
eating out of garbage.
They're eating out of garbage dumps. In fact, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and there is a scene of the poor rummaging through garbage dumps to survive in the Philippines.
Philippines, and there's so many instances of this in South American countries. The first time I even learned about it, I was completely horrified.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's take some calls, 313-298-WRIF, and Taylor had a comment here. Taylor, welcome to the broadcast. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
We're doing good.
Great. Hi, Taylor.
What's up with the graffiti?
I actually was originally going to talk about the graffiti, but over the time I was on hold, I had a question about the gentleman that called here earlier saying the problem about Detroit.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the racist?
Yeah, the one who had a really broad term that really didn't really, label the correct problem.
The really dumb guy. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm not defending him in any way whatsoever. But
not the butt!
That'd be the butt.
Not the butt!
That'd be the butt.
I mean, in the butt.
I'm sorry, go ahead. We're just having some fun. Go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say, please.
All right. Is this show not about voicing your opinion?
Hey,
you're doing it, dude. Go.
We did not cut him off.
We did not do that, people.
We did not do that. All right. Let's see. More graffiti. Here's Jerry and Warren. Jerry, hi. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter, and hello, lady. I'm not sure who the lady is.
I'm Sheila. Hi. No. How are you?
Good, Sheila. How are you doing?
I've never been better.
Oh, my gosh. I'll tell you, they always say truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah?
Well, graffiti got me arrested.
How come?
Well, I put some graffiti on my own garage door.
What city?
Well, I have to tell a little bit of a backstory. I have a little problem, an ongoing problem with my neighbors.
All right.
I like this story.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. I put some pumpkin plants between the houses. Pumpkin plants, okay. My pumpkin plants got pulled out. My hose got slit. I had a good idea who did it. It was one of my neighbors. And I put on my garage door, I spray painted, I said, "These neighbors suck," and I had an arrow pointing to my neighbor's house.
Okay, now listen, I'm not sure that's art, but go ahead. But I got it.
It is graffiti.
It's not necessarily art, but I was trying to get my message across. Now, this has been going on. It's an ongoing problem since last November, and it ebbs and it dies out. You know, sometimes we get hot with each other.
All right, but wait a minute. We got to stick to the headlines here. But somebody called the police?
Well, yeah, one of the neighbors called the police, and I've gotten to know a lot of the police people around here.
Headlines, come on.
Yeah, so anyway, they arrested me for disorderly premises.
Wow.
Because of the graffiti on the garage door. I have a court date coming up on August 1st. That's a week from this coming Thursday. It's a misdemeanor charge. Uh-huh. I spent 74 hours in lockup before I was arraigned.
What?
Yes, 74 hours in Warren PD lockup. For that. And what happened, I had two choices. My brother petitioned me to the court for an involuntary admission to a psychiatric hospital. Or I could go sit in Macomb County Jail under $2,500 bond. So I took the prior. And I'll tell you, I got in, they took me to a great place. They took me to a Henry Ford Hospital. And I met a lot of people, and I learned a lot, too. I got re-medicated. I'm not ashamed to say it because God gave me something I have to deal with for my entire life. I'm bi. And what I mean by bi is bipolar.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
That's what I figured, too.
Yeah.
I'm on new medication.
Good.
And I'm 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 10 Celsius, by the way.
I got to tell you this. This is a very interesting story.
Just leave the little tidbits out.
But we've got to move on, and here's what I'm going to ask you to do. When this comes, for one thing,
did I read this in the news?
I don't know. I was going to say, you should contact the newspapers about it, and I can't hear you now, whether you have or you haven't, because I got to move on. And if you haven't already, and you better go there with a good lawyer. All right. Well, thank you. And call us back when this gets adjudicated. All right. Thank you very
good
much.
Good luck.
Because I don't know. I would not like to have my next door neighbor say, my neighbor's sucking an arrow towards my house.
I don't think I'd enjoy that.
Is there a free speech?
I would never have an
issue.
But
that's horrible that,
everything that ensued.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see. Here's Phil in Canton. Phil, you're on the air.
Wow.
Welcome.
Hi, I just wanted to call and say that you guys are talking about what's going on, and that last guy was all over the place.
Yeah.
And he says he's bipolar. But
he's medicated. No, some people are just all over the place naturally.
Yeah.
Well,
with me.
Usually, they're all over the place because they've been malnourished for years and years and years.
Wait a minute. I resemble that.
Yeah, exactly. And they're not, They're not drinking enough water. They're not eating healthy.
Okay.
And they're not exercising. And I think if you look at statistics, if you look at what cities are thriving, the people are healthier, eating healthy, exercising. They have a strong body and mind.
That would be Grosse Pointe. That would be Birmingham.
No, that'd be San Diego, Orlando, all those cities.
Orlando.
So you don't think it has a little bit more to do with the economy and where employment is and things like minimum and living wage?
Because tell you what, I eat well and I exercise and I still ramble. Come on.
Everybody says they do, but they don't necessarily do. I'm an exercise specialist, okay?
Oh.
Everyone says that they do, but if they don't eat every 4 to 5 hours, they're not drinking lots of water, they're addicted to pop, they're addicted to smoking, that causes your brain not to get the proper nutrients.
All right, man, I got to tell you, I am so healthy then. And I still ramble. I drink a lot of water.
We go on and on, haven't you noticed?
And I drink water and water and I exercise and exercise.
Yeah.
All right, thank you
and
for that.
And you, for sure, you're the real deal there.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, here is Mike. And go ahead, Mike, you're on the air. Where are you calling from?
White Lake.
White Lake, okay. Go ahead, you're on the air.
What's going on?
Yeah, I talked to you guys, about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, and you were, kind of promising that, Obama was going to stand behind, competitive wage.
We never have promised anything about Obama, so.
We're proposing that Obama was going to do this, and he did.
Do what? What?
Push now.
You're cutting out. You have a terrible connection.
These right-wingers talk about they got something called Obamaphones.
Oh, God.
Which
that is
not.
So ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah, it is ridiculous, but you need to get one. I can't understand what you're saying. You get a better line.
An Obamaphone. They don't exist. Just get a new phone.
Get a better line and call back. Really? Get on a landline or something.
Yeah.
Call us back tonight. We got about 50 more minutes. It's not coming across. Let's see. Where are we going next? We are going to Tony. Tony is in Sterling Heights. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
We're good.
I love Detroit. I was born there. Wasn't raised there too long. But I work there, pay taxes. So you tell me what's going on with the city.
You're asking me to tell you what's going on with the city?
Yeah. Have you been listening since the beginning of the show by any chance?
Well, I'm going to tell you this much. I work there.
Peter, get ready.
I won't walk around there.
You won't walk around there?
Nope. I'll go to Hamtramck, but I won't walk in the city of Detroit or Highland Park.
Well, it's funny. I do.
I do, too.
I used to live in Highland Park, yeah.
What part of Detroit do you walk around?
I'm downtown all over the place.
Downtown. Come walk by where I work.
Where do you work?
Oakland Avenue.
So what? Wait a minute. Normally I'm not in those areas. Although there's very few places in Detroit that I wouldn't go. I was born and raised in Detroit as well. Born and raised hell in the Motor City, as I usually say.
Right.
Yes, you did.
I stopped. I told my dad I'd stopped raising hell, and he called me a quitter.
You have not ever stopped.
But
don't be fooling. What is that?
Let me ask you this, Tony. What does that tell you? That areas are relatively high crime and are absolutely high crime?
Obviously they are.
Well, so what does that tell you?
You tell me.
No. You brought it up. I'm not sure.
Do you have any ideas? You got anything to throw out there?
No, I'm asking you. So there, as we know, that poor districts all over the world generate high crime. So it's evidence of poverty.
Yeah, and it's called survival.
And I'm wondering what you think about it.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, every neighborhood, well, the neighborhood I live in, I can leave the doors unlocked.
No. Let's go back to Detroit. We have areas in Detroit that are high crime, and you were pointing that out, actually pointing out the obvious that everyone knows, including the people that live in those neighborhoods. And I used to live in a neighborhood like that in Highland Park on a street called Fern Park, just a little south of Davison. And, in fact, I was hearing a statistic today that actually comes from FBI crime statistics that said in poor neighborhoods like that, whatever, wherever they are in the world, or in this case, in Highland Park, that you can find 5% of people involved in crime, which makes it close to unlivable. I mean, you know, that in most areas where you live, like in Sterling Heights or where I live, 99.9% of the people are law-abiding. And even the crime of the 0.1% probably isn't violent or breaking your house. Mm-hmm. But it goes with the territory of poverty. I mean, when you have a situation where you have 300 of the richest people in the world have more than 3 billion that are so impoverished, when they're forced into the cities by economics, whether it's Nairobi or outside of Manila or outside of Lima or in Detroit or wherever, you're going to find a lot of violence and a lot of crime. So to me, it's the other way around. I mean, what are you seeing of this? That's what I mean. What it shows to me is that when you structurally create poverty as the key definition of your society, that is, you have these ultra rich people, this little sliver of the middle class, and then this enormous mass of poor people, one of the penalties that you're going to pay is to have, no matter where you are in the world, is to have areas that you can't walk in. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, so then what do we do as a common person? Such as me and you.
Well, that's a tough one because when you have impacted wealth that allows cities to go down the drain, all the while that these banksters and scamsters on Wall Street enrich themselves beyond any capacity to take money or to get wealth that they could enjoy. In other words, if I said, hey, Tony, or you said to me, hey, Pete, I'm going to give you another $50,000 a year, we would go, oh, boy, and we could probably think of about 15 things right off the top of our head we could get. But when you start having a personal fortune of $31 billion, it's impossible. It's impossible to consume all that. So that just means there's this enormous wealth at the top that completely distorts the nature of the economy and the people that suffer on the low end of it. And so maybe maybe like the Koch brothers or the Waltons, they can buy everything they want and they can start their own art museums. They can have their own performing art centers and what have you, named after their names are on the wall.
They can have whatever they want.
And all that. Yeah. But that means that, that Tony and Peter are going to be, and the people that live there are going to be in jeopardy every time they walk down Oakland or something like that. All right. Let's leave it at that. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. And to blame it, as a basis of race, and the idea, I mean, I don't even understand it. Never mind. Here's somebody that can explain it to us. It's Maurice in Detroit. Hey, Maurice. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello,
what's up?
Peter.
Hi.
It's Julie.
Yes.
Judy Quain.
Sheila.
You know, one thing I would like to say, I live in Detroit, and when I go to sleep at night, I leave my doors unlocked, let somebody come in, they won't walk out.
We know how many guns
like
you
the,
have,
it's
Maureen.
It's like the Roach Motel.
About the Trayvon Martin thing.
Trayvon.
I had a last year, May the 6th, that was on a Sunday. I was in a similar situation. I had somebody that hit me in the head, knocked me down on the ground. They were standing over me.
Yeah.
Normally, I would have my gun on me, but it was a setup. The young lady always said, well, you don't need your gun on you with you in the house with the kids. Well, I used to leave my gun in the back room empty. I had the magazine in my pocket.
So your yeah. own girlfriend set you up?
I said lady friend.
Oh, lady friend.
Sorry, Maurice.
Hey, listen to what I'm saying. Now, the guy was standing over me.
Yeah.
What about Mike was standing over this guy?
Yeah.
Similarly, he used bad jazz to get out of the car.
Yeah.
He could have walked away. If I would have had my gun on me, I would have emptied the clip in him. There would have been 13 shots from 40 caliber.
You would have you would have emptied the clip into who?
To the guy that knocked me in the head.
And you're saying hypothetically Trayvon was standing over him because no one knows that, but to the
but
person.
What I'm saying is, Trayvon Bonifor, whatever you listen to, the guy, Liverman was down on the ground.
Well, wait a minute. Why couldn't Trayvon?
Maurice is fired up tonight.
Why couldn't Trayvon Martin have claimed, had he not been killed by George Zimmerman, why couldn't he have claimed stand your ground?
Yeah.
I mean, here's this law-abiding citizen, a young man, a teenager. Some people have, you know, child, I don't know if I want to call it 17-year-old, a child. And
a young man.
A young man. And somebody is trailing him against the instructions of the people who he had called. And I think probably what happened was that he grabbed Trayvon Martin. I mean, why can't I say that? I mean, it has as much validity as anything that George Zimmerman said because, you know, he killed the only other witness.
Right.
And so, like you're saying, if someone, say that would have been there, just, you don't know who this is. Some guy says, what are you doing around here to you, Maurice? And you say...
We know what Maurice would
do. Yeah, Maurice would shoot him.
It wouldn't be pretty.
Yeah, it wouldn't be pretty. But say you were unarmed. Say your lady friend told you you didn't need it. And some guy grabbed you by the arm in the middle of the night. And you were just walking with just some you know, candy and tea in your hand. I mean, he probably would have smacked him. And I would say that probably, given all of this talk about stand your ground, that's what Trayvon Martin could have claimed had he not been... And I'll say it, murdered by
that's right.
by George Zimmerman.
Hey,
all right,
Maurice, did you clarify this? Your lady friend set you up?
Oh, let me tell you, the dude I knew from the neighborhood, he used to go around, and you say, think you still there? I said, told him like this, go get the baddest person you know, and I still screw both of y'all up. And she used to go around and say, you think you tough? So the dude, he thought he was bad. He had to wear his sunglasses for 2 months because I gave him one half of a black eye.
I'm not getting this. All right.
I love your story.
Maurice, everything disappeared on my screen. I hope it'll come
there
back.
It
All
is.
Right, there you go.
You're
okay.
Back.
It's back. Here, back to graffiti. One of the things we were talking about, we had a public illustrator, guy who's done a lot of stuff out in public, huge murals, Kobe Solomon. And so we got into a discussion about graffiti. Some of what he's done and commissioned to do on Pierce Street in Birmingham, right in the hoity-toity area. So,
pretty cool.
But let's get Steve from New Haven's fix on graffiti. Steve, you're on the air. What do you think?
I want the show to be placed from there.
Wait. just yeah. Bye-bye. Bye, sweetie.
Yeah. All right, we got some open lines. 313-298-WRIF. Kevin, I want to get to you next, but hold on. I want to talk about a little more. All right. So here is the deal. The idea that people, you know, so when people just make these statements that Detroit has high crime areas, that's what I always want to know. And what? Well, I mean, what does that tell us? What it tells me is that you have a concentrated poverty there. and that the bonds of community fray, particularly among younger men, and the people begin preying on one another. And it goes with the territory of poverty across races, across ethnic groups, yeah, across countries, and what have you.
I mean, then that is just a fact. If anyone wants to try to argue with it, good luck. But
yeah,
it's
and
a fact.
I mean, for instance, when you know that if you go to Michigan prisons, a disproportionately high number of people are African Americans. You go to Iowa. Guess what?
Where I'm from?
Yeah, it's a high percentage of white people in there. You go to places like Arizona, high percentage of Latinos and
yes,
Native Americans.
Yes.
Guess what? They're the poor. And when you have, you know, usually the poorest people are always designated. I mean, they're designated by race. So, but when you get stuck in an area where, the whites have the franchise on everything, then you get white people that are the criminals. Because the poor people.
Poor right? white people.
Poor white people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of Indiana, actually we were saying Iowa, wasn't it? I was.
Yes.
Yeah. What do you think about this, folks? I was stopped somewhere. I look at an Indiana license plate, and the design was the American flag, and it said on it, "In God We Trust."
Really?
And I'm thinking, what is that? I would not put that on my car.
I think there was some controversy over that
in
from
God
what
we
I
trust.
Recall.
Come on!
I mean, it went to court, and they won the ability to allow that.
Okay. Let's, here, let's get, oh, yeah, wait a minute, Kevin. I wanted to, excuse me, I didn't mean I called you Kev, because that's a friend of mine's Kevin. Let's call him Kev.
Okay.
But I don't have
it's
your permission.
It's okay.
I don't have your permission. Yeah, here. Get this, and here's why people are poor. An attempt by the city council in Washington, D.C. to force profitable chain stores to pay much higher wages than the city's minimum has infuriated Walmart. Now, remember,
oh, no!
the Walden heirs, these people that, quote, did not earn it, they were given it, are worth $125 billion. And we're talking about $18 billion. That,
between like three or four of them, correct?
It was even up to five, or, yeah. I don't know, three, four, five. And they're threatening to pull out of six stores that they have planned for Washington, D.C.
Because?
Because they're talking about trying to force them to pay a living wage. Imagine, we will not pay a living wage. I mean, how can they say that?
Yeah.
The mayor, Vincent C. Gray, he's done everything he could to get Walmart in there, and he's kind of caught in the middle. The city council passed a living wage measure. And note the language, you know, living wage. They want to give people a wage that they can live on. So it's $12.50 an hour, which I think totals up to about $25,000 a year.
Yeah.
That's a grand sum, isn't it? Their net income of Walmart was $17 billion, but the revenues were $469 billion. They're like the third largest company in the world. And let's see, the day before the city council passed the measure, a Walmart official warned in an op-ed piece in the Washington Post that if required to pay $12.50 an hour, the company would cancel three planned stores. This is the effing mafia.
Yeah, and this is how the effing mafia called Walmart operates, Peter. That is when, for example, in Canada, and I think, I don't know if there's other places in the United States, I can't remember that, but when they tried to unionize the employees, they just closed the damn store.
Yeah. Because now you say, well, wait a minute, they have a duty to their stockholders. The Walden family owns 48% of the public stock. Other investors own 52%. So they could actually say, look, we're worth $125 billion, and we want to pay our employees $20 an hour. We want to have the best benefits that we can. We want to have daycare, and we want to have gardens on the roof and all that. And doing all this, we might wind up with only like about $80
billion. Oh,
between, no. Yeah, right. But besides being the largest retailer, they also drive out the local merchants. But here, I mean, say if some of you are saying, well, it's their store and if they, you know, whatever, and they give people a chance to, what would you think if you are dumb enough to have those thoughts? I know I'm not being very polite.
I'm very naughty.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm
going to turn my headphones down. All right. That you were subsidizing Walmarts, that you were subsidizing these multi-billionaires, these people that have more money than God if she existed, right?
Yeah.
Like right. Because here is the deal. The we wind up, us, you, me, everybody, wind up subsidizing Walmart because employees earn so little that they qualify for Medicaid, food stamps, and housing assistance.
And not only that, in addition to that, in, say, their break room or their lunch room, they have instructions. Walmart puts instructions up, management, telling people how they can get that assistance.
How to apply, yeah.
That is so, that is just so twisted and wrong.
So we're paying their bennies. You and I are paying the benefits for
people
Walmart.
Who are working 40 hours a week.
Yeah, for Walmart workers because Walmart won't pay them a living wage. So let's see. Victor L. Hoskins, the deputy mayor for development of Washington, said Walmart's threat to cancel projects if the measure took effect was no bluff, which I agree.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
He calculated that 4,000 retail and construction jobs were at stake from three of the projects. The question is not 8.25 versus 12.50. The question is 8.25 versus zero. It's called no jobs.
Yep.
This is called capitalist blackmail, folks. All right. Let's go on with our calls. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Kevin in Detroit. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Welcome.
How you doing, Pete?
We're good. So is Jalene.
Pete, I've been listening to you for over 25 years, and I'm a black guy. Okay?
Yeah.
And I think you, if anyone ever heard on the radio, that includes this jockey, black or white, you wouldn't have a right to me because I've joined you for over 25-plus years.
Yeah.
I think he said, did you say you've enjoyed him?
Well, I enjoy meeting him because I've enjoyed listening to him down through the years.
No, thank you.
Ah, I didn't think he didn't hear that, so that's why.
Okay. Well, the issue with Trayvon is this. Now, Zimmerman was told not to follow him, correct?
Right.
Yes.
And he did it anyway.
Right.
Isn't that in itself is wrong? And what I can see were a lot of whites. Can't just acknowledge that fact.
Well, I think that they can't get past their own whiteness and their prejudices, well, honestly. And I think that's a big part of it.
You know what, Kevin, and while I'm talking, can you do me a favor and turn your radio completely off while we're talking? Because I'm getting some feedback from it besides my headphones. One of the things I said last week, which if you've been listening that long, you may have heard as well, even if you want to make the argument that as the jury did, that Zimmerman was technically not guilty, and I say the only other direct witness was killed by the one who is telling the story, and for some reason or other, people that think, oh, that was a great decision, they state Zimmerman's version of things as though it was actually what happened. And what I was saying to them is, what if Trayvon Martin would have only been seriously wounded? What if they would have brought charges against him for assault with intent to do great bodily harm by shooting this unarmed teenager? What would Trayvon Martin's story have been? Would he have said, yeah, I just saw the dude and smacked him in the face and then tried to kill him by banging his head against the cement? Of course not. That's not what he would have said at all. And who knows? I mean, we never will know. But one of the things that I said, and no one would refute this, and I think I'm just repeating what you're saying, Kevin, is that George Zimmerman is responsible for setting those events in motion. Trayvon Martin was simply walking through this subdivision. It was raining out. He was, he had stuff in both hands, and he was approached by this man who instigated the situation and ultimately bears responsibility.
Yeah, and one of the jurors says, well, he just went too far.
Yeah. You bring, like, it's called bringing a gun to a fist fight? That's going too far, huh?
Yeah, I would think so. And then somebody like Geraldo Rivera said, well, you wear a hoodie, well, you should expect things like that to happen.
Well, I just don't know what to say. I mean, I know a lot of African-American and even white parents now are telling their kids, don't do that. You could wind up dead.
And speaking of that, I think when we come back from the break, when we go to the break, we should talk about President Obama, who
All right,
said
Kevin,
some pretty strong things this week.
Thanks for being such a long-time listener. Yeah, we'll do that and some other things that we'll clear up in our final segment. In fact, it has to do with the cover. The Rolling Stone.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jolene will be taking more of your calls right after this. 101 WRIF.
Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
Get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 8/31/13.
Are you self-employed, stuck on COBRA, or did your health insurance rates just take a huge jump?
Listen to this.
I'm Josh Cush of J.P. Cush & Associates. You've seen the signs. And when I founded J.P. Cush & Associates, I promised myself that my customers would always get the best health coverage at the lowest rates. Call me now at 855-4-JP-CUSH before the rates go up even more.
That's 855-4-JP-CUSH to get a quote today.
That's 855-457-5874.
Or go to jpkush.com. J.P. Cush & Associates. 855-457-5874.
Grip the road on a Can-Am Spyder at K&W Cycle in Utica on July 25th. With the confident handling of its exclusive Y-frame design, two wheels in front and one in back, Can-Am Spyder delivers a combination of exhilaration and control that you've never experienced before. Come out and try the Can-Am Spyder of your choice for free at K&W Cycle in Utica, July 25th. Discover riding. Reinvented. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment. Let's get this on the air.
Take all kind of pills to give us all kind of thrills, but the thrill we never know. It's the thrill that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
All right, we get it.
Yeah, well, I didn't Rolling Stone back in the news because that they put on the cover of their this month's magazine, one of the Boston bombers, the accused Boston bomber.
The accused alive one.
Yeah, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. And
really, a huge controversy over that. People were not happy.
Yeah, whether it was appropriate to put it on it. I mean, they call him a monster on the cover. They say, how did this, you know, let me see. Well, I'm seeing a bunch of covers, but not the one I wanted. But anyway, I can't see the language right here. It's on our website, isn't it? Did you put it up there? Not on our website,
no,
on our
no, remember?
Facebook?
You didn't send it to me.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So then that this police sergeant released 14 photos showing the 19-year-old Tsarnaev. How am I saying that? Tsarnaev. There you go. Why don't you told me I don't have trouble with saying names.
Listen, Reej, Tsarnaev, I gotcha.
Tsarnaev. Yeah, Reej. Emerging from his hiding spot in this boat in Watertown, and his right hand up in surrender, his head buried in his arms, and another one with a red dot of a sniper's rifle sight trained on his head.
Yeah.
So, what do you think? Was this appropriate? You know, somebody made the point.
Well, they put Charles Manson on it how many years ago?
Rolling Stone?
On Rolling Stone, yeah.
Okay. No, I didn't know that. But,
yeah.
Like, Time Magazine had Hitler on the cover any number of times.
Yeah, and wasn't it a Person of the Year? Didn't Osama bin Laden get that or something?
He may have. I know Hitler did.
And yeah.
Because that's, you know, who... So what do you think?
Who made the news?
Is this inappropriate? You know, I could say this. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev.
Just hang it up. You're all right.
Is that close?
Yes.
Is it close?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. But if you want to mention that, hey, we've got some open lines. 313-298-WRIF. So,
now, Peter, on the Trayvon Martin thing, there were demonstrations across the country all week long. And also, I really want to mention this because remember Steel Pulse?
Yeah.
The reggae band?
Yeah.
They have a new song called Put Your Hoodies On for Trayvon. I think I'll put that on our Facebook page as well.
Sure.
Okay.
Why don't you do that?
So you can check it out.
Good song. Well,
and President Obama. That's what we're going to talk
President
about.
President Obama. Yeah. So it just sort of a strange. Did you see it?
I read it.
Yeah. No,
yeah,
it was
I
very strange listening
to
him. Yeah. But talking about his experiences as a black man in America. Someone, even as president, could have someone stand up to him and yell at him in Congress. You lie. Or have a minor elected official, a governor, shake her finger in his face. And all that registers, I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm trying to find. Oh, here we go. I thought it was really powerful, and your headphones are still squeaking.
That's okay.
he said some really powerful things, and I was happy to read what he said. One of the things that he said, I thought, well, here he goes, because people blame him, you know, get down on him for maybe not being as outspoken about things as they would like for him to be. And he said, there are very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happened to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African-Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often. And, he described his experience with race-based prejudice. There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me, he said. I thought it was really powerful.
It was.
Because it's the truth.
But you know what? I'm sad to say it probably doesn't resonate with a lot of people. Because in many white people, even in the warmest of them, they have a cold spot there.
Yeah.
It doesn't extend to everybody. Well, what are we
going to do? I'm glad he did it anyway.
Yeah, but you know what? Yeah, so am I. You said there's demonstrations across the country commemorating Trayvon Martin, thousands and thousands of people. And on Saturday, there was one in downtown Detroit with thousands of people, mixed races. And
I would have loved to have been there.
You know what? I didn't even know that it was planned.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking, what is going on? How come, you know, me, Mr. Demonstration?
Because you're not on Facebook.
There you go. That case in Milwaukee, I mean, I'm sure glad that came out to be guilty. Less than 24 hours after George Zimmerman was acquitted in the death of Trayvon Martin, there was a trial with some striking similarities. A white man shot and killed an unarmed black teenager. I'm sorry. Am I reading this wrong? I don't think he killed it. He killed this kid?
Yeah.
Oh, my. He did. Shot and killed an unarmed black teenager, this time a 13-year-old, Darius Simmons, to take the law into his own hands. The defendant, John Spooner, somehow I thought he'd been wounded, 76, did not dispute that he shot the teenager, believing that the teenager had broken into his house and stole his shotguns 2 days earlier. Mr. Spooner was found guilty of first-degree intentional homicide on Wednesday, moving the trial into its second phase, where defense lawyers will try to prove that he should not be held responsible because of the state of his mental health.
An old angry white guy.
Yeah,
that's the state of his mental health.
So he was, by the way, this is an older story, that he was found okay. But
who was found okay? What do you mean?
That he was found not insane.
Oh, okay. Because there's okay and there's okay.
Yeah. He was, you know, in other words, he could be sentenced under the Homicide Act.
Yeah.
Pat from Traverse City is calling and hanging up again.
Hey, woman, what are you doing?
Yeah. So, but here, this is what I, during the trial.
And we don't mean that in a bad way. Pat just has some kind of connection problem calling the show.
The shooting was undisputed by the defense. Mr. Spooner's house had been burglarized 2 days before, and though he strongly suspected Darius, the murdered teenager, of stealing four guns, the police said they did not find enough evidence to continue their investigation. Mr. Spooner then confronted Darius around 10 a.m. as the youth was retrieving a garbage can in front of his house and demanded the return of the guns, which the teenager denied knowing anything about. Mr. Spooner lifted a .32 caliber pistol and fired a shot into the chest of this 13-year-old. But here, it gets worse. The police handling of Darius' death was criticized as well. Officers would not immediately allow the teenager's mother, who witnessed the shooting, to accompany her son to the hospital, keeping her in the back of police cars for an hour and a half for questioning. They're questioning her.
Whoa.
They also then searched the family's homes for the guns.
Ugh.
And didn't find them.
Of course they didn't.
And arrested Darius's brother, who had unrelated municipal traffic warrants out for him.
Oh, my gosh. What a story.
This is incredible.
Yeah, well,
and they found this. And wait a minute. Let me see if I can find this. Because this Mr. Spooner, who some of the people said in the neighborhood, said, we all love that old man, said John Davis, 43, who is white and lives nearby.
Yeah.
Well, it's turned out. Let me see if I can quickly find this, because this is fairly incredible. No. Oh, yeah, here it is. This is a whole thing about this John Spooner. And he says that Spooner's daughter once brought home a kitten that he didn't want, so he took it to the basement and killed it.
Oh, my God.
This is the guy that shot the 13-year-old. Spooner also used to choke and beat his wife.
Oh, what a sweetie.
And
real nice guy.
The violence shows Spooner occasionally loses the ability to control his anger.
Oh, do you think? My gosh. So, Peter, the show is coming toward an end, and we've got some phones we need to get to.
One of them wants to know why you're raging.
What? Me?
Yeah.
Have you never heard me before?
Here's Luke. Let's see. Luke is in Clarkston. Hey, Luke, you're on the air. Welcome.
How's it going, guys?
Going good.
Is this the one who's wondering that?
No.
Okay.
No, not me.
No.
I'm bringing something new to the table. Well, not particularly, but a new vantage point. I heard you guys talking about Trayvon Martin and, you know, the very tragic case, you know, with George Zimmerman and, you know, obviously the death of this young kid and Barack Obama and his sympathy toward the situation and you know, his tears he shed over Trayvon. And I really want to point out the irony here that Barack Obama ordered the drone strike of Anwar al-Awlaki, who was a U.S.-born citizen, New Mexico, suspected of being, you know, an Islamic extremist, killed him in a drone strike without trial, nothing. And then his son, 16-year-old Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, 16 years old, grilling in the backyard with his cousin overseas, was also killed in a drone strike ordered by Barack Obama, who is, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, a child murderer, just as bad as George Zimmerman, but I would argue worse because he does it consistently, you know, with all of these drone strikes overseas that he will not stop. God knows how many women and children he's killed.
Yeah.
You know, he's
hundreds, actually.
He tries to hide behind this whole, you know, he tries to hide behind the Trayvon Martin cases, you know, this big stoic sympathizer.
I don't know about that. I think that's
I think that
we agree
Barack
about
Obama,
the drones.
The whole American drone strike and the fact that the son, who I congratulate you for remembering the name, which I don't, but he was, quote, killed by accident. He wasn't not the intended target, but he was just what do they call it?
Collateral
damage, which is a very, very broad term that this man and every president that has used the term, including his predecessor, has hidden behind, you know, under which I think penalty of serious, serious persecution. I think him and George Bush are both eligible for horrible, horrible war crimes. But somehow this man, you know, manages to, you know, be the spokesperson for Trayvon Martin, you know, a young teenager who was killed, you know, you can argue by accident, by George Zimmerman. So, you know, what was more accidental? The collateral damage of Barack Obama's drone strikes that he's fully aware, you know, they entail collateral damage, or, you know, George Zimmerman, you know, who we'll never know.
I think on one hand, I absolutely agree with what you're saying.
About the drone strike. The connection
reaching. It doesn't, I don't think Barack Obama was the most articulate person on matters of race. I mean, he didn't do too badly. But when you start looking and Eric, I mean, I can't think of anybody's
name. Well, I thought
this
was beautiful what he said this week.
Well, you should have heard some of these people that I was listening to. What's his name? Dyson. What's this guy's? He's sometimes on MSNBC. I mean, these guys can just
Eric.
Eric something, right. Dyson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's incredible. But no, your point about
Stop the drones. What, yes, Peter?
I was looking at what somebody said. All right, Luke, but your point is well taken. Thank you very much. Tony called in to say, stop putting down white people. Hey, it's a dirty job, Tony.
Wait,
somebody's got to do it.
That's a good one. I don't know. Yeah. That may be the line of the night.
Yeah, yeah. All right, here is Joe in Howell. Joe, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. The Trayvon thing, but what happened with the officers? With the, did they not let the mother see his their child?
Oh, this wasn't
no,
true.
This
was
a
case.
Story.
Yeah, this was a different case. This was in Milwaukee when this crazy old guy shot this 13-year-old, 76-year-old guy shoots a 13-year-old. By the way, he was considered a law-abiding citizen, you know, with his gun. With his gun,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they always are law-abiding until
they're not.
Until they shoot somebody, yeah. And then so they treated the mother and they as a criminal, and they. And the Milwaukee police.
While her son was dying.
The son was dying, and then they searched the home on the accusation of this murderer. Turn out that there's no evidence that the child, and he can be called a child at 13, that the child was involved in it. And they figure, well, we're in these colored people's homes. We might as well arrest the brother. So, you know, they take him in. And even the Milwaukee police said it was handled in an insensitive manner. And I'll tell you, let me go back to Tony and stop putting down white people. Of which, you know, I'm from a European
background.
We're
putting down racists, okay?
Yeah. But those concepts, those social constructs of race are deadly. And there, I mean, some of us among of European stock have different attributes: blonde hair, black hair, blue eyes, green eyes. You can go from Nordic people of the north to Southern Italians, which, by the way, were not considered white in congressional testimony in the 1920s. So
what are we?
What?
What do you mean? Well, what is it?
What?
We're not considered white.
No, that Italians were, Southern Italians
oh,
were not.
Oh, they were not. I thought you said we're.
Now, by racists, that in congressional testimony.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So all of this stuff is just shifting. And so that skin color, pigmentation, should have no more bearing on our consideration.
On a damn thing.
But it does right now, and it's almost demonstrative. Everyone, almost everyone of you can't even say both races, sounds stupid, but for lack of a better way to put it, let's say that when someone enters the room, that's one of the things you think, oh, that's a white person, that's a black person, that's an Asian person. And it depends on how benign it is. Yeah. If it's, I mean, when I go, and I don't like to be in places.
Like in what way?
Maybe Tony's right. Well, when I go in a restaurant and it's all white people, I don't like to be there.
It's really boring. Let's mix it up. Come on.
Yeah, let's mix it. No, I don't know. I mean, I've been in lots of places where I've had great times where it's all white people. There's, you know, like that. But there's something wrong. I'd much prefer events
diversity
in the city of Detroit, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, a little white bread old me over here from Iowa. I got here and I was like a kid in a candy store. I'm like, oh, my gosh, finally, people of different races. I love you, people.
Here's Kevin. Kevin wants to ask a question.
Wow. Am I on the air now?
You're on the air now.
Kevin, you are live.
Okay. And, ma'am, your name's Jalene?
No, it's what is it?
Sheila.
Sheila.
Tonight.
Okay, Sheila. I was the one that commented on your rage.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and what it is, it seems, and you don't even have to scream and yell, it seems to rage these days. It's just one side of the story, and it doesn't even matter if it's this one or that side story. When somebody gets raging, and you do it by the white guy, all these little digs out there, who are you digging on?
Who am I digging on? Have you listened?
Yeah.
What, you want me to go through the list? And you know what?
Yeah.
Listen, what's your name again?
My name's Kevin.
Kevin. Okay, Kevin. Here's the thing. I run into this once in a while because I'm a female with very strong opinions, and oftentimes there are men like you who find that uncomfortable. And I'm sorry that you feel uncomfortable, but I'm not going to, you know, calm down or anything. I'm passionate about my opinions.
I didn't tell you to calm down, but it's like, who was that guy? Oh, he's just a crazy white man. He's some 76-year-old.
Peter does the same thing. Why aren't you getting on Peter? He was the one name-calling earlier in the show. I haven't necessarily been doing that.
Me? What I'm saying is that you're like, it's from the information you gave after you decided to talk about the story, 76 years old, he's an abusive psychopath that beats his wife. You know, how crazy can you get?
Well, listen, Peter and I, we resigned from the white race many, many years ago in the interest of humanity. You like that?
I was 15 years old. I'm like pushing 50 now.
Yeah.
And I would lay in bed, 15 years old, listening to him just like, wow, this is great. Now I moved back to Detroit, picked him up again, and
Peter,
I've called once, but you're just like bizarro world, like.
Thank you.
I was going to say, that's a compliment.
You have no idea how much we appreciate that. You made my night.
All right, thank you.
And welcome to Bizarro World.
Welcome to Bizarro.
Enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, this is not Beat the Press or whatever it is. So
this is not entertainment tonight.
Yeah,
okay, we're handling very tough issues, and I understand there are a lot of men who are extremely uncomfortable with women with strong opinions.
And also, here's Winston Smith calling out same thing of the hypocrisy of Obama and the Obama administration. We had
this is on an email.
Yeah. Someone earlier was saying that, you know, Obama is okaying these drone strikes that are killing civilians.
Mm-hmm.
Not one, but hundreds of people, including children, including women. And Winston Smith said, you're right about Obama having some strong things to say this week, but he had nothing to say about the crimes of the Bush administration, or the crimes of the banks and the Wall Street operators who sank the economy. Nor did the wooden Indian attorney general have anything to say about those things. But he's been rather vocal about the Zimmerman-Martin issue. Well, you know, they are separate things. I mean, I have, you know, if someone said to me, you know, do you support Barack Obama? I would say no. And then I would go down. I don't mean on this question of race. I mean, you know, when they ask overall support,
well, as far as
approval,
war
approval,
goes, environmental issues,
yeah.
There are a lot of issues that, you know.
He's an American president. He's not going to go up against the banksters. He's, you know, he's done the idea that Mitt.
Did you almost do it again?
Mitt Romney would have been the president. I mean, I just can't even begin to believe how much worse things would have been. And I mean, he might as well have invited the Koch brothers into. He probably would have had tea with them all the time. All right, let's see.
No pun intended.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Rick, you have exactly 60 seconds and counting. Go ahead. Rick, you're on the air.
No pressure.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Good.
No, you just used up 5 seconds. Yeah,
I've been listening, y'all. I grew up the time of the Grandy Ballroom in Plum Street, and y'all know what I mean. I think that's what time that we all should go back to, when we could all sit down, smoke the peace pipe, and be cool. You know what I'm talking about?
Let's just be cool, man.
Let's leave it at that. It doesn't get any better than that. All right, Rick, thank you very much. And if you don't know what the Grandy Ballroom was.
I wasn't around.
You know where that at the top of, like at noon, they say, I want to hear some Revolution? That was live at the Grandy Ballroom. All right, got a couple of great interviews. Carolyn Raffensperger. She's next. And then also a pal of mine. Whose name I can't remember. No, I do. John Hartig, who's going to be talking about Detroit River.
And how species are coming back because of the cleanup efforts.
All right. Jefferson, thank you.
We help you with
John
that.
John Miller, thank you.
Thank you, guys, for answering
for listening.
The phone.
Thank you for calling. And Jalene, keep on raging.
I will, damn it.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
101 WRIF, locking in everything that rocks.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit GEICO.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
101 WRIF.
Welcome to
Everything That Rocks.
And Chuck the Freak Mornings, 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, it's been said that everyone is an environmentalist. Beginning 40 years ago or so, we began Earth Day. People began paying attention to what we're doing to our planet. And one would think that things would be getting better. But looking at things like climate change, the disappearance of species, what's happening to our air and land and water, it doesn't look necessarily like we're off in that direction. We have to find ways to live in balance with our planet. There's people that are thinking about this, though, because it has to be thought about and approached in a systemic way. I mean, sure, it's helpful that we're going to recycle or something like that, or walk instead of ride in our car. But we've got to look at the big picture. And someone who looks at the big picture is my guest who's in the studio with me, who is Carolyn Raffensperger. How did I do? Almost.
Almost.
Yes.
Raffensperger.
Raffensperger. There we go. All
Yay.
Right. I've been talking with Carolyn about her last name. She said, let me say it. You've messed it up twice before. But more importantly, Carolyn is the director of the Science and Environmental Health Network, and you can go to SEHN.org. She's also a lawyer and an archaeologist, and she teaches in the master's program of social justice at Mary Grove College. Carolyn, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you.
And I was just found your website, and that's why I gave it right off the bat, SEHN from the Science and Environmental Health Network, to be so fascinating because you bring up concepts rather than just saying we need to fix this or that this is broken. Tell us a little about the Science and Environmental Health Network, and I'd like to get into some of its basic concepts that are there.
Oh, a couple of decades ago, the environmental community gathered together and started looking at how the media told the story of environmental problems. And we had some pretty serious toxic contamination in a place called Love Canal. And the toxic chemical that was contaminating Love Canal was called dioxin. And the newspapers were saying things about dioxin like it's as safe as sunbathing. And this is before we thought about skin cancer and sunbathing.
Right.
And they were completely undermining the science that told us that dioxin was a carcinogen, caused cancer. And so the environmental community gathered together in Washington, D.C. and said, you know, how is science being used and how is it being misused in environmental policy? And so I'd been working for the environmental movement for some time, and I thought that I had some ideas about that. And so we gathered together and created an organization that basically said, we need to put ethics together with science to make our decisions. And so we began a series of projects and a fairly large body of work that I think changed the environmental decision-making on its head. And when I came into environmental work, I was told that the only thing that mattered in environmental policy was science. And so we left it to experts. We were not allowed to make decisions on our own. And anything that you felt about it, that this was going to cause harm, that you could prevent suffering by taking a different action, whatever it was really not permitted as part of policy unless a scientist had proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that something caused harm. And that just seemed like a big problem when we knew we had some pretty good information that if you were exposed to a carcinogen as a child and that cancer didn't manifest itself until you were an adult, that proving causation was pretty difficult. And so we began unpacking those sorts of ideas and the idea of scientific uncertainty and how we acted in the face of scientific uncertainty led to a whole lot of other pretty interesting issues.
You know, as soon as you say policy, I suspect at least some listeners are going, yeah, I know what policy is all about. It's a bunch of people sitting around in a room having conference after conference, and the impact on the real world is probably fairly limited, if at all.
Well, I think that we've seen the impact of many decisions on our everyday lives. So the policies that run economics and our economic systems that allow, say, big banks to flourish, or certain policies about how we will give mortgages, or policies about who gets health care or who gets health care insurance, we see the impact of those kinds of decisions. We see the impact of policy on, you know, how many miles to the gallon a car gets, on manufacturing and on gasoline prices, et cetera. So policy is actually the set of ideas that are usually codified by government that direct actions and direct our lives.
Now, you recently gave a talk at Mary Grove College where you're teaching in the Master's of Social Justice program about governance. And so many people are just so cynical about government because government seems to very easily support the needs of banks and other big corporations, but very little to the environment, or we wouldn't probably be having this conversation or having the problem. So how does governance, how can we have an effect that the governance will be to the benefit of the planet and the beings on it, and not just to the big banks.
Well, you know, we've had a couple of 100 years in this country, in the United States, on some ideas about government. And those ideas were put into place by mostly a group of men sitting around in Philadelphia and other places, and they put these ideas into a constitution. And we think that that fossilized document is the only way there is to live and be. And we don't have a conversation about what government's for. Can you imagine a reality TV show on government and trying a whole lot of experiments on what government is for?
I'm afraid to guess, but go ahead.
You know, I live in Iowa, and because we hold the first caucus for the presidential candidates in the country, we see all of those candidates come through. And almost all of the discussions about government are about how big it is. So I joke that it's the one time that you see grown men arguing that theirs is smaller than the other guys.
yeah, okay.
And they don't talk about what government is for. And in this country, we have had a lot of rhetoric about how government gets in the way of the economy, which is the great problem solver, apparently. So if we just leave the free market alone, it will solve the environmental problems or it'll solve whatever else.
Well, that'd be for the environment. That'd be like the 1880s, right, with belching furnaces and no controls.
And no controls.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's regulation for? It gets in the way of those big banks making their money, which is supposed to trickle down to poorer people.
The first part of that is true, though. I mean, six biggest banks just reported earnings for the quarter of $183 billion. So the less regulation on them, the more money they make.
And did it help you?
No, of course. I mean, Detroit recently filed for bankruptcy. So there you go.
There you go. And we could talk about that, you know, around the country and the kinds of impacts that it has. So I will want to step back and say, what is government for? A great writer named Barry Lopez, who writes a lot about natural history, which is, you know, how nature functions, how ecosystems, and how indigenous people live in their natural communities, the communities of plants and trees and fish. And he said to me that we had had an experiment of a couple hundred years on government, and that experiment has failed. And essentially, we had had three branches of government. So you have the executive branch and the legislative branch and the judicial branch. But he said that we had put into place a fourth branch of government, which is corporations.
Hmm.
And that the original conception of government, having those three branches of government, there was a natural checks and balances that were put in place. But with the fourth branch of government, with corporations, there are no checks and balances. So stepping back and saying, what's government for? Not just should it be bigger or smaller, but what should we tailor government to do? What should we fund government to do? What tasks should it accomplish? So I want to offer two ideas about what government is for. And the first is that it is to defend and protect and possibly to expand rights. Now, the discussion in the United States over the last 10 years is probably about gun ownership more than anything else and the almost inalienable right to own a gun, which has been, I think, diminished into a private property right. I have a private property right to own a gun. But there are so many other rights that I think are interesting and that we don't talk much about. In large part, rights law is a fascinating area of law and policy because we don't buy and sell them for the most part. So if I tried to offer you my right to practice free speech, which I'm doing right here in the studio, we wouldn't even know where to go with that conversation. It's not something that we engage in trying to buy or sell my right to free speech. And so rights law are that area of law that we do not buy or sell and which are as applicable to the minority as to the majority. Now, there are lots of other areas of law that don't fit in rights law, and environmental law and policy is one. And so environmental law is actually free market private property law. And we buy and sell your right to be free of pollution.
Sure.
And so the question is, should you have a right to not be contaminated with toxic chemicals? Should you have a right to breathe clean air and clean water? And I would assert that you do.
That's, yeah, and that we're facing that now in the Detroit area. I don't know if anybody informed you about that, but the Koch brothers, interestingly, have a product called Pet Coke, the leftovers of their gas exploration, it's our sands operation up in Alberta, and they put these huge piles of Pet Coke, so it's Coke Coke, on the Detroit River banks, and the stuff is just blown into the river. So do they have a right to do that because it's their private property? I mean, the old thing, well, you know, when your rights end at the tip of my nose,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's not exactly where we're at, though.
No, because what you take in through that tip of your nose into your lungs
is Pet Coke.
And so the question is, should environmental law be free market private property law? And what would happen if we moved it into rights law? What if you had an inalienable right to a clean and healthy environment? So one of the things that I'm working on is to establish that right. And we have actually moved some things out of free market private property law and policy into rights law. So, for instance, we ended slavery. And we did not give slaves title to their own bodies so they could buy and sell themselves. We said this will not be an area of free market and private property.
Nor did we compensate the slave owners.
And we did not compensate the slave owners.
My guest is Carolyn Raffensperger. How did I do? Almost.
Yeah, Raffensperger.
Raffensperger, yeah. And it's my bad, folks. It's an easy, easy name, but you know me in names. She is the director of Science and Environmental Health Network. It's SEHN.org. I'd say a very important website to check out. She's also a lawyer and an archaeologist, which maybe we can get into a little of that. She's teaching in the Master's Social Justice Program at Mary Grove College. And on the website, there are some principles there. One is called the precautionary principle. Tell us how that affects the kind of policy you're talking about.
Well, when I began talking about scientific uncertainty, what we discovered was the way decisions are made in this country is through something called risk assessment. So that Pet Coke that you were just mm-hmm. talking about. So a regulatory agency would receive a permit application for putting that Pet Coke into that land, and they would evaluate the risks of that and decide if those were acceptable risks. And then they would do a cost-benefit analysis and decide whether the benefits of, you know, to the economy and to Detroit outweighed the risks. And in almost every case, we say, yes, the benefit to the economy is so great that we're going to allow the damage to the rivers, the damage to the children's lungs, the contamination, you know, of our entire ecosystem.
Is it really fair, let me interrupt you, I'm sorry, though, to say that it's a benefit to the economy? Actually, it's a benefit because you have a higher return of on your investment if you don't have to utilize as much cost to your operation. In other words, if you had to run everything under the principle of zero discharge, which should be the norm rather than the exception, you would have to expend more, and then you'd have less profits to distribute to your shareholders.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
You know, I'm going to come back to the precautionary principle in a minute and talk about the other role of government, which is to serve as the trustee, the steward, the guardian of the common wealth and the common health for present and future generations. Now, what are the commons? The commons are all of those things that we share, air and water, those rivers that are being contaminated, all fish and wildlife. You know, in Michigan or in Iowa or Texas, you go and get a hunting license or a fishing license because you're taking a share of the common wealth. And so government's responsibility, we have kind of devolved into thinking it is to protect the private profits of the Koch brothers rather than the river and the air and the water, which is actually the basis of the economy. Without the commons, we have no economy. The restaurant that we ate in last night doesn't do any business if you don't have a road and a sidewalk that provides access to it, and we share that road and that sidewalk. So government's role is not to protect private property and profits. Corporations do just fine on their own. Their responsibility is to take care of and enhance and restore the common wealth and the common health.
Well, you then are suggesting really a change, because certainly, I don't know, since at least the middle of the 19th century, the role of government has been to protect corporations and their ability to do business as they choose, no matter how dangerous it was to the health and welfare of the ordinary people. So policy, I mean, I agree with you, is absolutely critical, and people thinking about it in a systematic way to formulate ideas and even demands. But it really needs, does it not, an involvement of more than just policymakers, and that's why these environmental movements are so important.
Well, not just environmental movements, because environmentalism and environmental problems are also problems of poverty and racism. They are they're problems of public health, of individual health. These are not just isolated things. The environment is not just over there somewhere. The increase in breast cancer, in autism, in certain birth defects is astonishing. And so environmental causes of those particular diseases and chronic illnesses seem to me to be a good reason for looking at the environment and environmental problems that go beyond, you know, just some kind of economic redistribution of wealth.
Well, there used to be, you know, that the word revolution was so anathema to the mainstream and to the people at the top of things, but now they use it to describe hair coloring, so I don't feel any qualms about using it. I mean, essentially, then, you're talking about a revolution in how we approach our governance and how we approach the major aspects of life in this society.
Well, that's a loaded word, and I'm not going to bite on it, but I'm going to offer another idea,
okay,
which is that Ben Franklin was looking for some new ideas to run another experiment in government. So Ben Franklin's, you know, one of our great, great heroes.
Yeah.
And he went to visit an Indian tribe called the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois and looked at how they actually ran their governance. And what's really interesting to me about Ben Franklin is he looked around at the time and said, you know, we actually need some new institutions. And so he created the public library. He created the fire department. And I think that not just revolution, but we need these new experiments, these new visions, these new things. And that might take revolution. But I think that that we've had a failure of imagination. We've had a failure of the vision for the way that we want to live together, for a way that we can manifest good. All great religions and all great philosophies talk about reducing suffering and doing no harm and doing good to doing to others what we wish to have done to ourselves. And it seems to me governing on the basis of that kind of logic and philosophy is a good thing. And so the work that I do, and when we talked about the precautionary principle, it says you take action to prevent harm when you have two things, the likelihood of harm and scientific uncertainty. So you don't wait to prove cause and effect when you have a pretty good idea, pretty good information that this toxic chemical is going to cause this birth defect. You take action, you look for a better alternative, and you make the polluter internalize their costs rather than externalizing them onto the commons.
Well, when I say revolution, I'm certainly not talking about to the barricades. What I'd like to get people to do is to go to the community meeting or go to the hearing where people are, you know, that it always, I guess, shocks me when something is going to have an environmental impact on a whole region and you you go there and you know the other 18 people that are showing up for this.
I've been saying that the precautionary principle requires democracy. But in a representative democracy, we don't have democracy. And Jimmy Carter recently said that the United States does not have a functioning democracy. And I think that we need to add some new ideas. And one that I would add to policy is something that came out of Nuremberg. And what happened at Nuremberg in World War II was that the Nazis experimented on children, on Jews, on gypsies, did experiments without anesthetic and without the consent of the people that were being experimented on. And we have as a basic human right, a basic principle, that we do not experiment on an individual for science or medicine without their free, prior, and informed consent. Now, one of the emerging ideas internationally, coming through the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, is that communities have a right of free, prior, and informed consent before you do things that affect their future. Now imagine if that was the principle of democracy that we operated on. So when you went to that meeting, not just you're going to add your voice to people who aren't going to listen and they're going to nod and do whatever they want with the Koch brothers anyway, or do whatever they're going to want to do with the banks, but that it was your participation that either granted consent or withheld consent as a right of that community, as the full expression of democracy. So no longer is it simply giving, EPA or the Department of Natural Resources your opinion, which they can ignore at will, and you've said you've participated in the community meeting in democracy, but that there is actual consequences to getting together at that community meeting. And that's what we need to do together as, to reformulate a democracy that actually has meaning and teeth.
What form would this take? We were talking earlier off the air about that there has to be agency. There has to be some form through which people can express themselves. And the voting booth doesn't seem to be the first line of defense. In fact, it seems to be, to me, the one of the last ones. If there's people listening and they're saying, she's right. And tomorrow on Monday or whenever I'm going to, there are groups out there. There's established ones. There's new ones that come up every day to take on this or that abuse. But there has to be some form through which we can express this. And this doesn't exist right now. And I'm not demanding of you that you, write the history of resistance and renewal, but any idea?
I think that it's like yeast. My view is that the right people are here at this time for a very good reason. And if you are listening to me and there is some idea that has sparked you and the call of your own soul says, I have to do this, you might be the part of the answer. You might be part of the way that we get to solving some of these big problems and moving forward together. We are not acting in isolation. If you are dependent on me and me alone, we are in deep trouble. And I use the word trouble instead of a better word. I know is that we're in this together, and our skills are different. I can think in terms of 500 years or 250,000 years pretty easily. Somebody else can think more effectively in terms of 25 years. Someone who's not a lawyer may have a handle on the kind of music that that will give heart and courage to the resistance. Somebody else has the capacity to write the speculative fiction that gives us the vision of the future that we want to march towards together.
You know, you have an optimism, and I love people like you, because I guess I've been kind of pessimistic lately about the capacity for any change and what's happening to our world on every level. So when I see that kind of spark in your eyes, I go, yes, I'd rather have her view than mine. Are you optimistic about possibilities?
I am not.
Okay.
I'm not optimistic in the sense that I think everything's going to turn out all right.
I
quote the former president of Czechoslovakia, who said that hope is not optimism. It's the deep orientation of the soul towards what is right. And what I know is that so many people who are hearing my voice can follow it as a thread and know that their own soul is set to the same compass direction. And what does give me the ability to go on and to have that fire in my eyes is that we are not alone, that there are so many people who are working towards these same ends of justice, of wholeness, of an earth where there's monarch butterflies left for the next generation. And so I'm heartened by that. I'm heartened by music that expresses the sorrow and the fire. And I think of my job now as helping to hatch the phoenix that will rise out of the ashes.
That's wonderful. I like that. Carolyn Raffensperger. Nope, missed it. Raff, say it one more time for me. This has become like a little what?
Handball game.
Right.
Raffensperger.
Yes, Director of Science and Environmental Health Network. Please go to sehn.org. And Carolyn is also teaching in the Masters of Social Justice program at Mary Grove College. My apologies for butchering your name every single time I mentioned it, but you were wonderful, and I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast.
It was my honor. Thank you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
101 WRIF.
That's perfect.
Everything that rocks.
Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
Get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 8/31/13.
101 WRIF.
We take this to the next level. Oh, yeah.
The Riff. The Riff.
Back
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. If you've been listening to this station, you know we've been running public service announcements for a cruise that I took the other weekend on the Detroit River, something I've done every year, the last 8 or 10 years. And I host a State of the Detroit River cruise, and it's sponsored by the Citizens Environment Alliance of Windsor and Essex County. And a regular, along with me, I could actually call him a shipmate, is John Hartig. He now, and we'll talk about some of the past work he's done, is the refuge manager of the International Wildlife Refuge on the Detroit River. Now, we thought that was all just kind of parks at best, and at worst, Petcoke and U.S. Steel. No, there's a lot going on. And as usual, when John Hartig joins me, he's in the studio with me. John, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
We had us a time, didn't we? What did you say? Good food?
Well, it's good food and good people and perfect weather. It's a wonderful day on the river, and it's a good cause.
And I'm always astounded at the level of your information about the river, because I try to keep abreast of things. But you just told me, for instance, that one of the birds in the Great Lakes, the common tern, that there is a project, a restoration project for these little guys on Belle Isle.
Yes, Peter. The common tern is a threatened species in Michigan and Ontario, and it's one of these birds that in the wintertime goes down to Central and South America and then comes back and nests along the Detroit River. And right now they're nesting at on some abutments for the Gros Seal Free Bridge and the Gros Seal Pay Bridge. But we have one of their historical nesting habitats was Belle Isle, and they cut all the vegetation down. They discouraged the birds, and they went away in the 1960s. So for 50 years, we've had no common terns on Belle Isle. So there's a dike that goes out into the Detroit River that protects the water intake for the Detroit water system. And on that dike, they didn't do anything with the dike, and we said to them, might it be possible if we could put some common tern habitat out there, you know, some stone that they like to nest in.
Is that out past the lighthouse? Is that what you're talking about?
It's just yet to the lighthouse and then on facing the Detroit shoreline.
I know
there.
Where it is, yeah.
Yeah, near the golf course there, Peter,
right.
If you know that area.
Sure.
And so Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, Detroit Zoo and Detroit Parks and Recreation Department, some high schools in Detroit, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service got together, and we brought out stone, and some of these students actually placed the stone. And we've been working at it for several years now, and we even have audio boxes out there, Peter, that will have the calls of the common terns to track them to this site.
Wow.
And so this last year, we had a number of them nest out there, and we fledged two common tern in 2012 for the first time since the 1960s, so 50 years. And so that's a great success story for us that we can do this, and we're going to continue to work that site and try to increase productivity and make this habitat better for a threatened species.
Now, I suspect that many people that don't know birds very well would think, oh, it's a gull. But gulls are just kind of floating on the air. They look like they're just having the grandest time. And the common tern, T-E-R-N, the common tern is always busy. It's got this real kind of serious look, and it's just, you know, looking for prey down in the water. But, you know, somebody might ask, and I'm, you know, this is a horrible question, but I always suspect people are thinking that, why the big deal? So what if there is or isn't common terns in on the Detroit River? What a cruise one way or the other?
Every species, whether it be an animal or a plant, plays a unique role in the ecosystem, and how that fits all together is really important. They are an important member of our Great Lakes food web, keeps a balance in the food web. They're also an important indicator of ecosystem health. We know that common terns were affected by the organochlorine pesticides in the 60s and 70s, you know, the DDTs,
sure,
the dieldrins, the toxaphenes. And so they, as well as herring gulls and bald eagles and peregrine falcons and osprey, their reproductive success wasn't as great. So it's an indicator of ecosystem health. So if now the common terns are coming back, in part because the environment is cleaner and also because we are restoring some of their habitat, it's important to remember that if the ecosystem is cleaner for common terns, bald eagles and peregrine falcons, it's cleaner for you and me. So that's an important thing to remember.
John Hartig is my guest, and he is the refuge manager of the International Wildlife Refuge, of which this project about the common terns is part. And I was sort of stunned to talk about not having full knowledge of things. And, well, it's one of the reasons I go on the State of the Riverboat tour every year, is to learn about our important river. Tell us about the International Wildlife Refuge. You would think it would almost be impossible on the river, given, as I said, remember, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And there's a lot of ugly left there, although we should talk a little later about the good and what's changed as well. But tell us about the International Wildlife Refuge and what it consists of.
I think many people today, Peter, still have the perception of an ugly river, of the Rust Belt, that the Detroit River is nothing but a polluted river in the Rust Belt. And that couldn't be further from the truth, you know. Clearly, back in the 60s and even the 70s, it was one of the most polluted rivers in the United States. Think of all the industry that lines our shoreline that we passed on those boats. And think of the number of people, you know, in Detroit metropolitan area, 5 million people, you know, and all the runoff of the lands and the sewage that goes in there. So over the last 40 years, we've seen dramatic improvement of the quality of the Detroit River. We've seen a over 90% reduction in phosphorus concentration and loading. We've seen dramatic reductions in chloride loadings to the Detroit River. We've seen a cleanup of contaminated sediments, $153 million of contaminated sediments, the legacy of the Industrial Revolution. We've seen restoration of habitats. We've seen a 70% decline in mercury contamination of fish. We've seen an 80% decline of PCBs and herring gull eggs on Fighting Island that you and I passed on the boat. That's an amazing story of environmental improvement on the Detroit River. But what's fascinating to all of us that work on the river is that's not the best part of the story. The best part of the story is that now bald eagles are back nesting and producing young in 18 locations in Wayne and,
really?
And Monroe counties.
Wonderful.
We have osprey back producing young. We have peregrine falcons nesting in downtown Detroit and producing young, and on the Ambassador Bridge, by the way.
Hmm.
They've nested up there for the past several years. We've had a return of lake whitefish reproducing in the river for the first time since 1916. We have lake sturgeon back returning and spawning and producing young for the first time in 30 years. If you add all of that up, the return of osprey and peregrine falcon and bald eagles and common terns to a limited degree, lake whitefish, lake sturgeon, we're the walleye capital of the world, wild celery, mayflies. We are one of the single most remarkable ecological recovery stories in North America. And the reason that is because of how bad it was, starting from sort of the arsenal of democracy days when there were no pollution controls, through the 60s and 70s leading up to Earth Day, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. So out of this ecological recovery came the idea. A group of people from Canada and the United States were brought together, and they said, why don't you vision, think of what you would want for this automobile capital of the United States and automobile capital of Canada. If you had one thing, what would you want? And out of that exercise, that vision exercise, came give us an international wildlife refuge. And so Congressman Dingell picked it up, introduced legislation. It was signed by the president in 2001, and Canada has followed suit with a series of pieces of legislation. And we stand here today with North America's only international wildlife refuge in the industrial heartland.
So there, but it's a patchwork, right? Because there's
a patchwork quilt. There's some islands in the river, like Mud Island and Grassy Island and Humbug Island and Calf Island. There's some tracts like Humbug Marsh. There's some down in Monroe County. We have different agricultural lands like the Branshaw Unit that are being restored for coastal wetlands. So it's what we're trying to do is work with willing partners to cooperatively manage some lands. And in some cases, where a willing seller wants to sell their land, we purchase lands. And we manage it for fish and wildlife habitat and for wildlife-compatible public uses, like hunting and fishing and birding and those kinds of uses.
If you're just joining me, my guest is John Hartig, and he is the refuge manager of the International Wildlife Refuge. And John and I were part of a tour a couple weekends ago where we went up and down the Detroit River, not the length of it, but a good part of it, where we saw, as I said, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And John is eloquently describing the good. That must be just something in my dark nature, though, that I always see the bad because I'm thinking, well, now I'm forgetting the name of the group. There is a supervisory group for the Boundary Waters, a joint international...
International Joint Commission.
International. And I remember that their goal is zero discharge, yet they have no enforcement powers, as I remember.
That's correct.
And I think of everywhere up from Chemical Valley or whatever they call it up in Sarnia down to U.S. Steel and what you mentioned in passing but described during storms, how just millions of gallons of raw sewage go into the Detroit River. Is what is the impediment to saying, hey, you guys got like 60 days, you know, that's what I would say, 60 days or a year or 5 years to end any discharge into our, and I emphasize our water, or you know, you're being confiscated or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm getting a little extreme, but what are the impediments to stop the pollution that continues?
If we're talking about some of the persistent toxic substances, Peter, you know, zero discharge. What we need to do is if a compound is so toxic in the first place, it shouldn't be released to the environment.
Sure.
Number two, we need to work with corporations and businesses at the design phase to design out of our products these most toxic substances. And that's happening right now as we speak with design for the environment and a whole series, ISO 14000, a whole group of practices to try to identify the environmental effects and problems in the design phase and design it out so that we don't end up having to clean something up 15, 20 years later. So an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That's so important. In terms of the municipal waste, Peter, we have a long ways to go. These old cities, you know that Detroit, we're one of the old ones, you know, 312 years old. You know, we're one of the real old ones. And in old communities, years and years ago, they combined storm and sanitary sewers. So when there's not a lot of rainfall, everything works fine. The municipal waste goes to a wastewater treatment plant, gets treated to secondary treatment standards with phosphorus removal, and then gets discharged, and that works fine. But when it rains, the capacity of the sewer system gets exceeded, and raw sewage can bypass the wastewater treatment plant and get discharged directly into the Detroit River and tributaries, and that is a problem in these old ones. And on the Rouge, we talked about this a little bit. On the Rouge alone, in the last 15, 20 years has spent $1 billion on combined sewer overflows and urban stormwater runoff problems. And they have more to do. And clearly Detroit, you know, on the on the Detroit Riverside, we have more to do as well.
I don't know if this is anywhere near a solution, but don't some cities have, I don't know what they call them, delay basins or something so that everything, like during a big storm, everything doesn't rush down at once. It actually floods your street, but then it's allowed to just... Is that a help or is that a solution or is that just a little...
Absolutely, that helps. Yeah. Not only does it flood the street, Peter, but it can flood your basement.
Yeah.
You know, and it can back up and you can have raw sewage in your basement, and that's a human health hazard. So what they do is they have pumps in the system, Detroit being a very large wastewater treatment plant. They measure them in millions of gallons per day. A 1 million gallon per day is a major wastewater treatment plant. Detroit Wastewater Treatment Plant is 700 million gallons per day.
Oh.
And so, anyways, they can move flows around with pumps through the sewer system to move into places where they have more capacity. They are also building underground storage retention basins to capture this waste during a rainfall event, hold on to it, and then pump it into the wastewater treatment plant where it gets treatment before discharge. That's what's going on. Connor Creek is a great example of that, a major one right at the mouth of Connor Creek there that captures a bunch of the waste from that area. And you can see it from Harris Gentry Park.
Yeah, I don't even want to say what, as you know, what that Connor Creek is called, but you're up, yeah, Creek. Anyway, and I've seen people fishing in that, which I... Whew. All right, you on the boat ride we took, the State of the Detroit River cruise sponsored by the Citizens Environment Alliance of Windsor and Essex County, you related just any number of success stories, and one of them that I really appreciated because it involved citizens' participation was saving Humbug Marsh. And I wonder if you could relate that story. What was intended for it and how that was avoided?
That's a great human interest and ecological story. Back about 15, 20 years ago, a developer came in and was looking for some property, waterfront property along the river, and wanted to develop it, you know, and saw that there was the last mile of natural shoreline on the U.S. mainland of the Detroit River, Humbug Marsh. It had an island. It had a marsh. It had oak trees in the middle of it that were 5.5 foot diameter that had, you know, that were 300 years old that were alive when Cadillac, you know, founded Detroit. So they went down the process of trying to develop that, came up with a plan, and had to apply for some permits. And to have a permit to develop on the shoreline, you have to have a public hearing. So they called for a public hearing. I remember being there a very rainy spring evening and so
expecting probably about 15 people, all of whom you knew.
Yeah, expecting a very low turnout. And what happened, so many people came to Gibraltar Carlson High School that the state police had to shut the Gibraltar Road exit off I-75. The fire marshal had to close the gymnasium. There were so many people in there that exceeded the capacity. And most of them, the vast majority of them, were in opposition to developing the last mile of natural shoreline on the U.S. mainland of the Detroit River for housing, a golf course, a riding stables, a bridge to the island, and large mansions on the island, another strip mall in the area. It would have looked like suburbia. So out of that came a fight, and the citizens took it on, groups like Friends of the Detroit River, Detroit Audubon Society, the Sierra Club, all took it on and advocated for preservation that was something important that was part of their culture and part of their home. And the end result of that is that it was saved and it was purchased for Keystone property in the International Wildlife Refuge. And today it stands preserved in perpetuity for future generations. And next to it, in the very piece of property next to it, 44 acres next to Humbug Marsh, which is 410 acres, is a former brownfield that we've spent the last 10 years cleaning up. It is now cleaned up for public use standards, and we're going to build a visitor center there. where people can come. And the Great Lakes School Ship will dock there, Peter, that takes kids out on the river and lake and uses it as a living laboratory. It's connected to the Greenway Trail System. Right now it has 50 miles of continuous greenways that end up there. It has a kayak landing. It'll have a world-class fishing pier to catch a trophy walleye in the very waters where the national record for the professional walleye trail was caught. It'll have classrooms for kids. It'll have outdoor areas. It'll have 3 miles of trails through the woods. It's going to be a pretty special place and a unique destination for people in Southeast Michigan.
Now, one of the things we learned on the boat trip down the Detroit River was that there is a similar area in Windsor that also could and should be part, or it's not now part of the International Wildlife Refuge, is it? No.
No, it's not.
But this is also kind of facing a development prospect.
And there's a piece of property right near Ojibwe Prairie. Ojibwe Prairie in Essex County is a tall grass prairie and a very rare ecological community. And there is a piece of property that links Ojibwe Prairie to the Detroit River. You know, wildlife need corridors. They can't just live in a little patch, a little square, or a circle. So this piece of property is on the Detroit River, and it's owned by the Port Authority, and they're thinking of developing it. Well, we learned on the boat ride from Citizen Environment Alliance that they had a hearing, and just like Humbug Marsh, hundreds and hundreds of people showed up, and now they're looking at options. Is there a way they could do some of their industrial operations on land that already exists, that has deep water port, that has access to rail and highways? Is that there's several pieces of property that they pointed out to us that do exist, and could this be preserved, you know, for wildlife and for citizens in Windsor and Essex County?
Now, we're getting close to the end of our conversation with John Hartig, and I'm probably remiss in not asking you how long you've been at this. I know that being the refuge manager for the International Wildlife Refuge is just a few years' duration, and before you were the navigator for the Detroit River, and you've seen over the years, and you can tell me how many years, that things have been getting better and better, and I almost sense that in your mood, in almost if you'll excuse me, your eyes almost sparkle when you talk about this. You must have an incredibly good feeling about it all.
Yeah, well, I was fortunate to be raised in a family that loved the outdoors and taught a concept of stewardship. And, you know, growing up in the 60s, you know, you could see a lot of the pollution on the Detroit River. And I actually grew up watching the flames off the Rouge River when it caught on fire. At least I saw the smoke from my home in Allen Park. So I've been fortunate to be able to work on the Great Lakes I've been working on the Detroit River since 1978. Wow. So I've seen it in its worst times, and I've seen the improvement, and it's so heartening to see how far we've come, but yet we have a long ways to go. We know we've got issues of these old infrastructure, and we still have contaminated sediments. We still have places like Uniroyal in Detroit that we've got cleanup is underway on that, but we have more work to do. So there's a lot of work to be done, but there's a lot of benefits to be gained, too.
You know, actually, I'm completely remiss in not reminding people about the book you wrote and about when you mentioned about seeing the Rouge on fire, because you wrote a book about Burning Rivers, as I remember is the name of it, and we interviewed you about that. So please have a little advertisement for yourself and remind us about the title of the book and where it's available from.
Yes. Burning Rivers is a story of four rivers, Buffalo River in New York, the Cuyahoga, the infamous one in Cuyahoga, the Rouge, and the Chicago River. All were burning rivers. All have experienced an amazing revival. You can get it on Amazon.com.
All right. The website for the International Wildlife Refuge is pretty long, so I'm not going to say it on the air, but I will put it on my site, which is Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And as always, I want to thank John Hartig and his work with the International Wildlife Refuge for being on the program. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Peter. I look forward to seeing you on the boat next year.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Hey, you're going to want to listen to this?
101 WRIF, everything that rocks.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Detroit's new home for Dave and Chuck the Freak is 101 The Riff.
don't know where I've been.